You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
To the best of Flashpoints for the week of November 23rd, 2018. My name is Mike Biggs. Today on the program, we are proud to present sounds from this year's sunrise ceremony on Alcatraz Island for what's known as the Thanksgiving holiday. All this straight ahead on the best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
Francisco, I'm Dennis Bernstein. This is a special edition of Flashpoints. The un-Thanksgiving ceremony is happening here at Liberated Alcatraz. Indigenous communities beginning to gather. You can hear the sacred prayer in the background. The fire is burning. It is pre-dawn, but it is beautiful. Hundreds of people are on the way. The boats are arriving on the island, and this becomes a place of liberation. We're going to be here through the morning reporting for you on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Again, Dennis Bernstein here with freewheeling Frank Sterling. And you can hear the singers and the dancers are now coming up on the island, landed at port, and then came around the bend up the hill. And once again here in 2018, the indigenous communities are liberating this island where the first indigenous communities of this country were taken hostage by the U.S. cavalry. They were kept here on Alcatraz, and that is why the island was liberated in 1968, and that's why Radio Free Alcatraz has been going ever since. Again, joining me for this broadcast is Tony Gonzalez of the American Indian Movement. Tony, good morning.
Oh, good morning, Dennis, and greetings, my relatives. Welcome to another year here at The Rock, Alcatraz Island. We have a lot of history here, and we're here to also honor the men and women, the warriors, who took the island back in November 1969 for 19 months. And the leadership that was spawned from there, men and women, some are gone, but many and their relatives have continued this movement around the world. But it all started right here, 1969.
And there are big struggles ahead in the community with those of us who believe in the liberation of the earth, protecting the water. We're dealing with a white supremacist in the White House, and this has become a real challenge. The first thing, as you know, Tony, they did when they were elected is come back to Standing Rock, come back full steam ahead with those pipelines through the water.
And, of course, through the North Dakota and the overall national elections, we saw a comeback there in North Dakota with people who turned out to vote, even though that there was obstacles in the voting process in North Dakota. And lo and behold, the legislator who introduced, Dennis, that bill on voting, and you have to have a voter ID requirement,
right,
and an address.
Again, it was meant to disenfranchise as many indigenous members of the community as possible.
Well, yes, and indeed. And as a result of the elections 2 weeks ago,
yes,
he himself got voted out. Not only voted out, he's the one that initiated the legislation to introduce that racist voting process, but the person that beat him was a woman. And yes. Not only a woman, an American Indian woman.
Yes.
So we have a lot to be thankful for in the response of the voters and Indian people in particular, even though that these obstacles were before them. I think, Dennis, another obstacle that we want to talk about in, with the administration, the white supremacists, is how they perceive the caravan that is approaching here at the U.S. border, when we perceive them as our relatives, our brothers and sisters, in the continuation of migration. And in this case, they're seeking refugee status. They're seeking asylum status, which is very separate from immigration reform. And I think here in the circle at Alcatraz, the Rock, we have some people that might be able to address that specifically. So that and the extractive industries, as you say, we have much to be talking about this morning.
We're going to be talking about this all morning. Again, I want to let people know, Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez of the American Indian Movement, Free Will and Frank. We are on Alcatraz. And Tony, say a little bit about this. It's supposedly Thanksgiving, but this is the un-Thanksgiving a celebration here within the indigenous community. Everybody has this illusion that thanks to the pilgrims, the Indians survived. You want to talk about this day in that context?
Right. And as you say, un-Thanksgiving, which is a term or metaphor initiated by the late, great Bill Wapipaw of the Kickapoo Sekapok Nation. And he was one of the leaders here in the Bay Area, passed away in December of 87. But as you refer to this un-Thanksgiving day, tongue-in-cheek, you know, because every day is a Thanksgiving day. And the other is thanks-taking, because we know now we've assessed the sum of what has been stolen and taken and destroyed from Indian people. We're in the process of recuperating that vis-a-vis the decolonization, the resistance movement that has now spawned. I think from globally, Indian peoples from beginning 1992, that marked the 500 years of Indian resistance here in the Americas. But yes, the stories here for Thanksgiving, as people sit down today to have dinner, they should reflect on the history here in this country. What proclamation brought Thanksgiving about? But actually, it was around in the 1623s, around there, that the pilgrims of that time on the eastern shores joined up with some other disgruntled Indians and waged war against the Pequots and Wampanoags and others on the Atlantic coast. And on that particular fateful day, over hundreds of men, women, children were killed, and the survivors, both pilgrims, white people, settlers, and the Indians in that area who joined together, sat down to celebrate their survival from those massacres. So we should reflect on that, because Indian wars continue. And we want to highlight that by getting perspectives here on the Rock from different Indian people who are here about their issues, Dennis, that the taking is still going on.
And obviously that's going to be what we're going to be talking about. But before we get started, and as the people gather here on Alcatraz and they continue to arrive, I just want to get your response to, you're a former soldier. You went to Vietnam. Troops at the border to meet women and children. Trump delighting in the idea of them getting tangled up in the concertina wire. How do you respond to that?
Well, Dennis, I think it's utter disgust. Yes, as you say, I was in the military. I was drafted, and I was in Vietnam as a combat infantry soldier in the 9th Division, stationed down in way down south of Saigon as a military person drafted and seeing and hearing this military at the wall. Not only is it disgraceful, but the laws, both nationally and internationally, the violations that are occurring, and to have military personnel, U.S. military personnel. And as of late, I heard yesterday or day before, the president is saying if there's any trouble, shoot and take care of the business, you know. And these are gradual steps toward a military state, and we're witnessing that along the U.S.-Mexico border. There may be in the future a military wall of 2,000 miles across from California to the Texas-Mexican Gulf of the ocean there. So we have to be very cautious. And I understand that the interfaith community, the rabbi association or groups of rabbis are going down to the border. Veterans are talking about maybe going to show a display similar to what we witnessed at Standing Rock, 2,000-3,000 war veterans for peace. So there has to be a way of addressing this, but certainly they do have rights as refugees. They have rights to seek asylum, and there's international laws that the United States has signed on to make sure that that occurs. So we'll be monitoring that.
Well, this is what we're going to be talking about throughout the day. You can hear folks getting ready in the background. Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez of the American Indian Movement West. People are getting ready for this un-Thanksgiving, this celebration of the indigenous communities and what we can learn about saving the planet and the water from these communities who have been leading the way for, what, am I exaggerating, thousands of years?
Yes, yes, and yes, we'll have people addressing the environment and what they're doing in their communities. We have particular people here from Nevada, the Shoshone people, who the listeners might or might not be aware, but over 700 nuclear bombs have been detonated there on Shoshone land in Nevada for testing and otherwise. But it's the most bombed nuclear bomb nation of Indian country.
Well, we're going to hear about that and a lot more. I want people to stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're on Alcatraz, and the birds are in the sky, and we're waiting for the sun to rise. Stay tuned. Dennis Bernstein. We're on Alcatraz. This is a special edition of Flashpoints. I'm here co-hosting with our good friend Tony Gonzalez of the American Indian Movement. And Tony, you have a guest here. Why don't you tell us who's going to join us now?
Yes, Dennis, and thank you. And greetings to my relatives once again. And here we just heard earlier Didi Ibarra of the Ohlone Rumsen down along the coast here, who introduced and welcomed everyone. There's several thousand people here and more coming. But Didi Ibarra, you spoke and you said prayer and you sang, you and your people who are here. What can you tell us about coming, making your journey here, and the message that you have for people?
Well, we had a journey here. We are now currently in Southern California. And we traveled up here. Maybe it was an eight-hour drive. And we felt we had to be here to offer prayers, to thank our ancestors for this land of ours. I am the tribal chair of the Rumsen Ama Turatai Ohelone, which in our language is Rumsen people of the Ohlone land. Our land was at the Carmel Monterey area, original land, and I'm also the assistant director of the Southern California AIM chapter. And the issues we have with coming here today is we need to put down some prayers. We have so much devastation going on in California, within all of California, with the fires and just the terrible things that are happening, our missing, murdered Indigenous women that are not found. There's just so much violence that it's a time that's really necessary for prayers. We have all the immigration issues going on, and we have to remember we're all Indigenous. We're all one people, and we have to help our relatives and pray for them, do what we can, whatever's possible.
And Didi, thank you. And on that score of what, you know, on the, we are all related. And as we see the mass migration of people coming from Central America that started from Honduras, and now there's about 5,000-7,000 people that are coming. And we want to welcome them as brothers and sisters here in the hemisphere. Well, what additional words do you have on that? Because overall, there is a separation. We want immigration reform, but on the other hand, we want these people to be recognized as asylum seekers, right? As refugees. What do you and your people think about this migration or this amount of people that are coming at our borders?
I think these people have every right to be here. What people tend to forget is that the first illegal immigrants came over 500 years ago. Mm-hmm. And people need to remember that. They need to remember how they gained this country. We, as Indigenous people of this land, never gave them the rights to our land. They stole it. And now they're talking about other people trying to do that. Come on, they need to get real and remember that and have some heart and know that these people are just seeking a better life, just like they were 500 years ago.
Yes, and these people that you mentioned, the European settlers that came onto the shores, as we're here praying on this November month, they themselves fled the European continent for being persecuted for their religious and spiritual beliefs. And there's a lot of that seems to want to dominate that one particular spirituality, Christian views. And now we're coming together, trying to work together with the Christian people who are now here. How do you see the spirituality, Indian people's spiritualities on the rise?
Yes, I believe that people are claiming their native cultural spirituality. Me personally, I have a hard time being from the California mission system. Oh. And I know what happened to my relatives. I know how they were persecuted, how they were murdered and forced into Catholicism, Christianity. And the things that are happening, the things that the priests, the fathers, padres long time ago did to our people, they're still doing today. So I just can't understand how people could still be supporting that religious entity.
Dennis?
Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez. And I just want to, I'd like you both to talk a little bit about the fact that troops to the border, there are Indigenous communities that live on both sides of the border. They're having their lives turned upside down by this occupation. You walk out of your house and you're crossing a checkpoint. You want to talk about that, please?
Yeah, I don't think that's right. You know, I was at Standing Rock a couple of years ago, and I remember how it felt having to go through those military checkpoints, getting back into the camps, and I kept thinking to myself, what country are we in that we have to do this? So I can just feel what our relatives to the south are feeling, because, you know, we have relatives, we all have relatives on both sides of the border, and it's extremely hard to even keep in contact with them because of this. You don't want to cross that border for fear of what will be happening over there.
Final question, Tom.
Yes, and Dennis and Didi Ibarra that we're talking to here, that border that we're talking about, across 2,200 miles. And although the construction, the physical construction of the wall itself may be a problem, you know, for the current administration in doing, they are on their way to building that. In the meantime, we may be witnessing the beginning of a military escalation along that border. And when you have troops like that, there's bound to be problems. And the president has already said that, you know, the soldiers will have to do what they have to do.
They're getting weaponized.
They see this as an invasion. And you know, Didi and Dennis, as we're talking, I'm thinking about, I have a good friend here, Puxu Iwalikinya from Panama, whom we'll be talking to. But last year, with all the migration and that was going on in Europe because of the different Middle East wars, including Syria and all those countries being bombed, the European theater was deluged with refugees. Well, Sweden, as a particular country, Sweden took in 150,000 refugees who sought asylum. And here we're talking about a mere 5,000, 7,000. This country can absorb that and deal with the issue altogether. Didi Ibarra, I want to thank you for your words, your presence, your opening words here at the island to welcome everybody once again on Thanksgiving Day.
And again, you're listening to a special edition of Flashpoints on Thanksgiving. We are here on Alcatraz. Dancers are here. The fire is burning. The birds are circling the planet. And we're going to keep an eye on what's going on. In one moment, Tony, we're going to be joined by one of the organizers up from L.A. But for the moment, stay tuned. A lot more to come.
Oh, thank you.
Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez. We continue our interviews with folks who have come here for on Thanksgiving Day. We are here. It's a bit of a rainy morning, but the rain has stopped to make room for the ceremonies. And again, I want to bring back our co-host, Tony Gonzalez. And Tony's got another guest for us. Tony, who joins us now in our special makeshift studio here on Alcatraz?
Yes, thank you, Dennis. And indeed, we have Shannon Rivers here of the Etona Autumn. Akamirda Autumn of Arizona. And Shannon Rivers has been very active down in the southwestern area. And want to welcome you, Shannon. Who do you have? Elijah with you?
This is Isaiah.
Oh, Isaiah.
Say hi, Isaiah.
Hi.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for inviting me to your gorilla studio. It's beautiful here.
Yes, well, Shannon, please tell us your presence here. I know you're involved in your community.
Right.
What are the burning issues? How do you see the refugees that are embarking all the way from Honduras, making their way now they're at the border? How do we welcome them from your point of view?
Thank you, Tony. Just recently, the Autumn Humachkam, which means the people of the nation, put out a statement in welcoming our brothers and sisters from the south. We know that there are economic, climate, and even political refugees that are coming to our territory. Sadly, I just got word the other day that search and rescue was in the Autumn, Tono Autumn territory looking for woman who went missing. She was part of, we believe, the caravan, and there are unfortunately folks who kind of prey on those that are looking to cross the border at some certain areas along the U.S.-Mexico border. So we're working with that to try to find her. We believe she's still out there, 36-year-old woman. So these issues of migration and movement have been very pressing in our community. We know that people, unfortunately, with the U.S. policies and their imperialistic ways, have devastated many economies, not only in Central and South America, but throughout the world. And so people are moving to look for safety and security in places where it's very tumultuous lifestyles that are taking place. The cartels are still very much in charge of the northern Mexico, southern area of Texas, U.S., New Mexico, Arizona, and California. So we have to be cautious about those things that are taking place there. So, but I also, so for us as Otam people, we know that we welcome our brothers and sisters who are coming in from the south.
And I, Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez, and I want you to talk a little bit more about the havoc that is being wrecked by the troops on the border. You mentioned the Tonanonum. They live on both sides of the border. Their lives have been turned upside down. Could you say a little bit more about what this means to them? Because this is this occupation. They have checkpoints outside their houses.
Sure. So since 9/11, right after this this phobia that took place of people who were coming from the north, from the south. At the time, the Bush administration started to increase the Department of Homeland Security, Border Patrol security checks. And since 2003, we have seen this increase of Border Patrol and agents all along our territory in the Otam territory. Currently, the Trump administration sent out about 15,000 or 5,000 troops to secure areas in Texas and along California. But since that time, since 9/11 or since 2003, there has been a large impact not only to the environment, but to the lives of the Otam who are both north and south of that international border. There are 9 villages in Otam territory in Mexico, what is now called Mexico. It is still Otam territory. Sadly, however, some of those villages and those people that live in those villages have diminished, and they've been pressured to move out of those one of those 9 villages. So we still have relatives, the Hiachet Otam, that live on that site. Hiachet Otam are the sand people. There are 4 bands of Otam. There is the Hiachet Otam on that side of the border, the Tono Otam, the desert people, the Akamirt Otam, the river people, my people, and the Onkakamirt Otam, the salt river people.
And we're talking to Shannon Rivers from that particular area you described. And to give the listeners an idea, and Dennis, how big of a territory, I believe that Tono Otam in general is one of the largest reservations in the country. And along the border that you described, international border, U.S. and Mexico, we're talking about, 60, 75 miles? Or how long is that stretch? And it's getting militarized.
Right. So there's a 65-mile stretch of border along Mexico and Arizona that the Tono Otam encompasses the territory. There are so the Tono Otam Nation is the second largest nation or land base in the state of Arizona. The Dene Nation, Navajo Nation, there are 22 tribes, if you will, in the state of Arizona. But the Dene people and the Otam people, or the Tono Otam, have the largest land base. So we have quite a number of our relatives and brothers and sisters who have been impacted by the Border Patrol and the movement of the Border Patrol. I think I also want to say that with regards to the environment, we see the degradation and the and the separation of our people when it comes to medicine, medicinal plants, the ability to cross for good water or for medicines that are on that side of the border. Even though some people would say that border is porous, those settlers would say it's porous, to us it needs to remain porous. It needs to remain open.
And Shannon, and now, what can you tell us about post-elections?
Sure.
And what are the outcomes there for Arizona in particular? I understand that several indigenous women were elected into the legislature. What can you tell us about that?
Sir, we know that two women were, Native women, were nominated into the Congress. With regards to Arizona, Kristen Sinema was elected. She is Democrat. She is a non-Native woman. She supported she was supposedly friends with a lot of the Native folks, but recently she just sided with the Trump administration regarding the increase of border and military. And so what we recognize is that it's very hard to have these political systems that say that they are on our side, but we always go back. We also have Senator Flake, who I believe is retiring or quitting, the former John McCain, who was, we know his impact to indigenous peoples, and I'll leave that there because we are at ceremony and we do our best to respect those who passed on. But we see a lot of post-Trump, even the concerns, the rhetoric of racism and violence that Arizona is also known as one of the states who have white nationalists, rednecks who kind of control certain areas of the state. So we're a little concerned about that rhetoric going on. We've had a lot of policies in the state of Arizona, SB 1070, that impacted our community.
I want to thank you for your views, Shannon Rivers. And Dennis, I think that's a lot to be said, because among the elections, over 100 women across the country were elected into congressional seats, and that doesn't guarantee necessarily a progressive view from them either, as Shannon just described of how this particular woman was voted in, but she's siding with the Trump on the military. So we have to really scrutinize that development.
We're going to watch that very closely. That is Tony Gonzalez. I'm Dennis Bernstein. We thank you for joining us. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We are on Alcatraz for un-Thanksgiving, and you can hear the communities have gathered in the background. The dancing is going on. The fire is burning. And we're hoping to see a peak of light through a sort of cloudy, rainy morning. But the spirits are high and the belief is strong. Stay tuned. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein, Tony Gonzalez, and Free Will and Frank. We've got more for you. Be right back.
Oh, thank you.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Dennis Bernstein here with Tony Gonzalez of American Indian West. And we're broadcasting from Alcatraz on Thanksgiving Day. My partner here, Tony Gonzalez, has some guests that he wants to introduce.
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. And here I have David Alvarez Jr., and he's a student at Fresno State University down in the San Joaquin Valley. And David, you want to introduce who you're with here? Is this a fellow student
that you're with? She's one of our students from Fresno City College. Her name is Natalie DeAnda.
Welcome.
Welcome. And David, I know the campus work that you're doing is intertribal. Bringing the intertribal community from the campus to also do work in the community. Tell us some of the issues that you as students are taking on, both on the campus and on the community level.
So at this point, we're organizing to have a pipeline directly from Fresno City College to Fresno State University in hopes to find and organize through the Fresno American Health Project in Fresno a educational coalition to where we can to discuss and go over ways that we can decolonize our education system and move away from a Western type of education to a more traditional contemporary education, to where we can actually submit some of the ways and traditions that we practice from our old ways into today's education system.
And your colleague, Natalie, I wanted to ask you, as the outcome of the elections just happened, even across the country, there's 100 women were elected into the congressional seats there. And how do you perceive elections? And are you also involved, you and David, in getting people registered to vote, the importance of the vote, especially as we're coming to 2020 now?
As an Indigenous woman, it was very, overcoming to see other Indigenous women come into office for the very first time. And just like the occupation of Alcatraz, it put forth a movement of in our education system for there to be an Indigenous or Native American voice, and seeing it flow into my lifetime and being able to be inspired by these women, not just the Native American women, but all the over 100 women who were elected into office. And it gives me hope to see a future not only for myself, but for my son. Mm-hmm. And I'm proud to say that our future is colored.
Uh-huh. Oh, and David Alvarez in Fresno, as a Yaqui man yourself too, the intertribal community, what issues are other issues are you involved in that you want to alert people to?
The one of the main issues that we're looking forward we're combating right now is our health issues. You know, what we're going through as a nation, as Native people and as an Indigenous people, to decolonize our diets and to look for a new, healthier way of living, so that we can have better outcomes for our future. And decreasing the amounts of diabetes and heart conditions and heart illnesses. That way we can continue to strive as Indigenous people.
I want to thank you, David Alvarez and Natalie, among the students there at Fresno State University, and the issues that you're tackling on. And I can see that sobriety, being clean and sober, is a part of the work that you're doing. I want to thank you for that. Dennis, back to you.
Thank you both, and you are listening to Flashpoints. More to come here on Alcatraz as the light starts to shine on the island, liberated, former prison, now a place where people come to celebrate freedom and that the Indigenous communities liberated in 1969. We continue that struggle. Stay tuned.
And now we're going to sing another song that is the first song written in the Rumson Ohlone language in almost 100 years.
Cha sho to tara tai bu anantura cha sho to matai shire ismate kos cha sho to tara tai bu anantura cha sho to tura tai man ma ke shom cha sho to matai shire is ma ke chos cha sho to tara tai u anan tura cha sho to tura tai man ma ke shom
the words to that song mean the fire in the sky. feeds Mother Earth. The fire of the earth, it is our ancestors. And the fire in our hearts is what makes us strong. Thank you for having us here, for taking the time to listen to us. Everybody, please stay with a good heart, a good mind. Stay strong in prayer. We're at ceremony. And remember that. And I want to say, Ehe Shururu Inulapista Ime Kaukakai. Many blessings and good fortune to all my relations. Oh.
Tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya, 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 tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya, 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 tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya, tawi lawi hoya.
And we're back. This is Dennis Bernstein, Flashpoints with Tony Gonzalez, the American Indian Movement. We're in Alcatraz. The ceremonies continue. Again, my co-host Tony Gonzalez is here with some guests that he wants to introduce us to.
Yes, thank you, Dennis. And indeed, we have here Puxui Walikinya, and he's from the Kuna Nation down in Panama. And Puxui came here also on the invitation from AIM West, as we had an American Indian Movement West Coast Conference, to share his views and perspectives on how his people are doing with the question of autonomy, with the question of extractive industries, and how they continue to challenge for their right to self-determination with the current Panamanian government. And so I'll be asking Puxu, introducing him in English, and we have graciously requested David Rodriguez to help us with the translation for Puxui Walikinya. So share your words with us about your presence here, having been with the American Indian Movement West Conference this past weekend.
Bueno, yo vengo de Cunayala, territorio de los Cunas en Panamá. Vengo a visitar a los hermanos indígenas de los Estados Unidos. Movimiento Indio me invitó. Así que aquí ahora estoy en una ceremonia muy importante para nosotros.
Good morning. I came here through an invitation from AIM, and I'm here to celebrate with the ceremony this morning, which is very, very important.
Bueno, yo vengo del territorio Kuna, que compone 49 comunidades. Nosotros somos totalmente 49,000 personas, y lo interesante es que nosotros poseemos un territorio que se llama Kuna Yala.
Kuna Yala is a region out in Panama, and it's 49 different communities, about 49,000 people.
Bueno, para conseguir un territorio es una lucha muy, muy grande. Nuestros antepasados han sacrificado. Ahora el pueblo Kuna más o menos estamos mejor que antes. La situación económica no hace falta y ahí estamos trabajando.
Economically, everything is we're still working at it. Territorial disputes have been prominent, but now we're standing at a better place than we have in the past.
Bueno, nuestra economía se basa en el mar. Mayoría, nosotros como vivimos en el mar, islas, ahí nosotros dedicamos la pesca, la producción, un poco de producción de la tierra. Así que más o menos nosotros estamos mejor que otros, parece que otros países de América Latina, los indígenas que viven ahora.
The economy is based on the ocean, it's based on fishing and a little bit of land work. And right now, the economy is doing a little bit better than other countries have been in the past.
And more better than more indigenous peoples in that area as well. And for our listeners to know, the Panamanian government just didn't give the Kuna their autonomous territory. They struggled, they fought for it. 1925, was very decisive when that land was demarcated. So maybe Pukshu might want to tell us about 1925 and the conflict there where their peoples asserted their territory.
Sí, exactamente. En 1925 tuvimos un confrontamiento con el Estado panameño por estar ahí que quitarnos la tierra, nuestra cultura, nuestras tradiciones y nuestros antepasados tuvieron que enfrentar las situaciones difíciles en esa época.
And our ancestors back in 1925 did have to face the government because the government was taking away land. And so it was a very epic fight that they had to go through at that time.
De ese momento para acá, nosotros poseemos un territorio. Ese quiere decir, nosotros vivimos dentro de nuestra área, ¿no? De la madre tierra, ahí nosotros vivimos y en el mar. Ahí pues todo el mar, territorio, quiere decir también la tierra, el mar, ese para nosotros es lo esencial, importante para vivir nuestras generaciones.
So the territory is set, it's there and in the ocean, and that's where the people have been living for some time now.
I know that the Kuna people in the Panama, there's a lot of extractive oil, gas industries are wanting to go. Is that a big threat for the people, the oil and gas industry? Are they trying to penetrate into that Kuna territory?
Bueno, nosotros, como decía, que territorio, como nosotros tenemos territorio, la ley existe ahora, todo el proyecto en nuestro territorio tiene que estar consultando con los indígenas cunas. Si no, no puede haber un proyecto grande de petróleo, de otras cuestiones de la tierra que puede explotar. Tiene que ser consultado. Eso es lo esencial para nosotros.
He's saying that there has to be consultation with the indigenous tribes in order for any extractive industry to come into the area.
Yes, and we'll be working alongside Pukshu Iwalikinya and others to develop a workshop to be more clear on the extractive industries as it relates to both Panama and here in North America. And Pukshu Iwalikinya, I wanted to also get your views on the current refugee in the caravan that's coming, that started from Honduras and are now at the U.S. border.
Bueno, nuestra filosofía, eso es. Lo que significa para nosotros es, nosotros no tenemos delimitaciones, nosotros no tenemos que nos divida. Todo ese territorio pertenece a la humanidad, nosotros respetamos eso, pero los gobiernos no han dividido, nosotros nunca estamos divididos antes. El gobierno han dividido y ellos quieren que nosotros estemos y que pidiendo pases, pidiendo permiso. Ellos nunca han pedido permiso cuando llegaron por primera vez de Europa.
They're saying that division is not a natural human tendency, that there are no borders, that the different various governments did not ask for permission to come into our land, and that is not a natural state for his people to consider that there are divisions.
Yeah, I want to thank Pukshu Iwalikinya and David Rodriguez for also with the translation. And as Pukshu said, 1925 was very decisive for their own independence. So 2025 will mark 100 years of their liberation and their autonomy. So Pukshu Iwalikinya will invite everybody to come there and share the 100 years in 2025. So Dennis, back to you.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're on Alcatraz. More to come. Stay tuned.
Okay, gracias, gracias. Muy.
And we're back here on Alcatraz. We thought it would be an important way to end the show to bring a significant person who really relates back to the beginning of this occupation of Alcatraz and the liberation of this island by indigenous communities of North America. I want to bring in Anthony Gonzalez of the American Indian Movement West and tell us who our special guest is to conclude our show.
Thank you, Dennis, and good morning once again, my relatives. And here we have Vaughn Oaks, and it always pleases me to see Vaughn here on the rock, on the island, and indeed for our listeners to know that she's the daughter of Richard Oaks, who was among the primary organizers, along with California leadership, to bring the occupation about that began in November 1969. For 19 months through June of 71. And I wanted to welcome Vaughn. And I see your son is here also, Elijah, at the, tending the fire, the grandson of Richard Oaks. The tradition of activism and coming to the island has become a part of your efforts to continue the struggle. Yeah. So welcome, Vaughn, and give a message to everybody here on behalf of your family.
I would like to say thank you and good morning to everyone all over. I would like to say that no matter what struggles you're going through in life, pick it back up, pick up the ink, and give thanks for another day, and stand strong, and continue on. And I know from my personal experience that our family has gone through struggles all this 40 years. I'm just trying to get back to this way, in this good way. They call it the red road, and it's a good road to be on. And if you are drinking or if you're on alcohol, I mean drugs, put that down and get up and stand. And we are with you. We are here waiting for each and every one of you out there.
Oh, thank you, Vaughn, for the words on sobriety and being clean and sober in our work. And would you share some words about your concern about the fire that went on here in Butte County and all the destruction and all the loss of life and the animal world? It's going to take a while to rebuild, but you want to share words to the listeners about the faith and prayer now that is needed for healing?
Yes, yes. You know, they say that when things like that happen, you know, it's a good thing. That when something better is gonna come along, when something dies, then that means something greater is coming. And we can see it, but only God can see that. It's unfortunately that it has to take lives and take the land and take, you know, animals. But it is a new beginning for others to stand and replenish this Mother Earth for what it is, for taking care of her. And we can do that together as we all heal. I felt bad for those that are up there because where I am, Santa Rosa was that way last year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know what it's like to just lose everything and be in chaos and don't know which way is up, don't know which way to go. You lose everything, but thank God we don't lose ourselves. Hold on to that tradition and do what you can in your community.
Oh, thank you. Vaughn Oaks, and what she's talking about, Dennis, also includes the over 70 lives that were lost in Butte County with a fire. Over 10,000 homes have been destroyed. It's going to take the whole town of Paradise being wiped out. It's going to take some time, but we're in a time of prayer here. 600 people are still missing, and the smoke has cleared up, and we're having a beautiful crystal day here. The sun has yet to rise, and so much activity. And this morning star is right above us. That's been here the whole time. And it kind of even corresponds with Morningstar, who's our host here on the Rock on behalf of International Indian Treaty Council.
And it's good to have you as a co-host here on Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a tradition we do here that we continue. Free Will and Frank's got the microphone, and we're delighted to be able to broadcast this for our listeners on KPFA Pacifica Radio. Good morning.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
Welcome to New World Notes. hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, more of Chris Hedges' powerful speech on the corporate takeover of the U.S. and how to rebel against it. I hope you'll stay tuned. Last week, we heard the first part of a rip-roaring talk by progressive journalist and activist Chris Hedges. It focused on the slow-motion coup by which the corporatocracy overthrew liberal democracy in the United States and replaced it with casino capitalism. The coup was well underway in the 1970s and was essentially completed by the 1990s. So for Hedges, Donald Trump is simply an artifact of this coup. Trump is a symptom, he is not the disease. In this week's installment, Hedges continues exploring the coup and then explains what forms resistance can take now. Spoiler alert, forget about the Democratic Party, but look to individual and collective acts of nonviolent rebellion. I am condensing this part of Hedges' talk, cutting out some long parts that are basically theology. Hedges spoke at an event called Stop Fascism, held in Portland, Oregon, in June 2017. Let us return to Chris Hedges.
Constitutionally protected statements, beliefs, and associations are now criminalized. The state can detain and prosecute people not for what they have done, or even for what they are planning to do, but for holding religious or political beliefs that the state deems seditious. The first of those targeted have been observant Muslims, but they will not be the last. The outward forms of democratic participation, voting, competing political parties, judicial oversight, and legislation are meaningless theater. No one who lives under constant surveillance, who is subject to detention anywhere at any time, who has lost their legal rights, who cannot protect themselves from corporate exploitation, whose conversations, messages, meetings, proclivities, and habits are recorded, stored, and analyzed, can be described as free. The relationship between the state and the citizen who is watched constantly is one of master and slave, and the shackles will not be removed if Trump disappears. The dismantling of democratic institutions, places where the citizen has agency and a voice, is far graver than the ascendancy to the White House of Trump. The coup destroyed the two-party system. It destroyed labor unions. It destroyed public education. It destroyed the judiciary. It destroyed the press. It destroyed academia. It destroyed consumer and environmental protection. It destroyed our industrial base. It destroyed communities and cities. And it destroyed the lives of tens of millions of Americans, no longer able to find work that provides a living wage, cursed to live in chronic poverty, or locked in cages. Perhaps even more ominously, this coup destroyed the credibility of liberal democracy itself. Self-identified liberals such as the Clintons and Barack Obama mouthed the words of liberal democratic values while making war on these values in the service of corporate power, and this rendered these values meaningless. The revolt we see rippling across the country is a revolt not only against a corporate system that has betrayed workers, but also for many, the tenets that define a traditional democracy. And this is very dangerous. It will allow the radical right with or without Trump, to cement into place an Americanized fascism. The acceleration of deindustrialization by the 1970s created a crisis that forced the ruling elites to adopt a new ideology, as Sturt Hall explains in his book, Policing the Crisis. This ideology, trumpeted by a compliant media, shifted its focus from the common good to race, crime, and law and order. It told those undergoing profound economic and political change that their suffering stemmed not from corporate greed, but from a threat to national integrity. The old consensus that buttressed the programs of the New Deal and the welfare state was discredited as enabling criminal black youth, welfare queens, and social parasites. These parasites were to blame. And this opened the door to an authoritarian populism begun by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, which supposedly championed family values, traditional morality, individual autonomy, law and order, the Christian faith, and the return of a mythical past. It turns out, 45 years later, that those who truly hate us for our freedoms are not the array of dehumanized enemies cooked up by the war machine, the Vietnamese, Cambodians, Afghans, Iraqis, Iranians, even the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS. They are the financiers, bankers, politicians, public intellectuals, and pundits, lawyers, journalists, and business people cultivated in the elite universities and business schools who sold us the utopian dream of neoliberalism. We are entering the twilight phase of capitalism. Capitalists unable to generate profits by expanding markets has, as Karl Marx predicted, begun to cannibalize the state like ravenous parasites. Wealth is no longer created by producing or manufacturing. It is created by manipulating the prices of stocks and commodities and imposing a crippling debt peonage on the public. This casino capitalism is designed to prey on the desperate, young men and women burdened by student loans, underpaid workers burdened by credit card debt and mortgages, towns and cities forced to borrow to maintain municipal services. This seminal moment in human history marks the end of a long, tragic tale of plunder and murder by the white race. It is inevitable that for the final act, we vomited up Trump. Europeans and Americans have spent five centuries conquering, plundering, exploiting, and polluting the earth in the name of civilization and human progress. They use their technological superiority to create the most efficient killing machines on the planet, directed against anyone or anything, especially indigenous cultures, which stood in their way. They stole and hoarded the planet's wealth and resources. They believe this orgy of blood and gold will never end. They do not understand that the dark ethic of ceaseless capitalism and imperialist expansion is over, and that it is dooming the exploiters as well as the exploited. But even as we stand on the cusp of extinction, we lack the ability to free ourselves from the myth of human progress. Walter Benjamin wrote in 1940, amid the rise of European fascism and looming World War, this. A Klee painting named Angelus Novus shows an angel looking as though he is about to move away from something he is fixedly contemplating. His eyes are staring. His mouth is open. His wings are spread. This is how one pictures the angel of history. His face is turned towards the past. Where we perceive a chain of events, he sees one single catastrophe, which keeps piling wreckage upon wreckage and hurls it in front of his feet. The angel would like to stay, awaken the dead, and make whole what has been smashed. But a storm is blowing from paradise. It has got caught in his wings with such violence that the angel can no longer close them. The storm irresistibly propels him into the future to which his back is turned, while the pile of debris before him grows skyward. This storm is what we call progress. The more the warning signs are palpable, rising temperatures, global financial meltdowns, mass migrations, endless wars, poisoned ecosystems, rampant corruption among the ruling elites. The more we turn to those who insist that what worked in the past will work in the future, that progress is inevitable. Factual evidence, since it is an impediment to what we desire, is banished. The taxes of corporations and the rich, who have turned most of our cities into wastelands, are cut. Regulations and laws are rescinded. To bring back the supposed golden era of the 1950s for white American workers. Public lands are opened up to the oil and gas industry, even as rising carbon emissions doom our species. Declining crop yields stemming from heat waves and droughts are ignored. War becomes the principal business of the kleptocratic state. Magical thinking is not limited to the beliefs and practices of pre-modern cultures. It defines the ideology of capitalism. Quotas and projected sales can always be met. Profits can always be raised. Growth is inevitable. The impossible is always possible. Human societies, if they bow before the dictates of the marketplace, will be ushered into a capitalist paradise. It is only a question of having the right attitude and the right technique. When capitalism thrives, we are assured we thrive. The merging of the self with the capitalist collective has robbed us of our agency, creativity, capacity for self-reflection, and moral autonomy. We define our worth not by our independence or our character, but by the material standards set by capitalism: wealth, brands, status, career advancement. We have been molded into a compliant and repressed collective. This conformity is characteristic of totalitarian and authoritarian states. It is expressed in the Disneyfication of America, a land of eternally happy thoughts and positive attitudes. And when magical thinking does not work, we are told and often accept that we are the problem. We must have more faith. We must envision what we want. We must try harder. The system is never to blame. We failed it. It does not fail us. And all our systems of information, from self-help gurus to Hollywood, to charlatans such as Trump, sell us this snake oil. What does resistance look like now? It will not come by investing hope in the Democratic Party, which did not lose the elections because of Comey or the Russians, but because it betrayed working men and women on behalf of corporate power and used its machinery to deny the one candidate, Bernie Sanders, who could have defeated Trump, from getting the nomination. The proposed cuts, $9.2 billion from the Department of Education, $616 billion from Medicaid and the Children's Health Insurance Program over 10 years, $200 billion from the food stamp program, a lifeline for 44 million people, $72 billion for people with disabilities, $39 billion for subsidized student loans, and $859 million for public service loan forgiveness, along with a $500 billion increase to the Pentagon's budget over the next decade. Accelerates the austerity programs and militarism that has been embraced by the Democratic Party. As Diane Ravitch pointed out, for example, the Democrats bear as much responsibility for Betsy DeVos as the Republicans. DeVos's proposed voucher system allowing parents to use public funding for private and religious schools is modeled on a school choice program introduced by then-Governor Bill Clinton. This voucher system was promoted by Obama and Arne Duncan. Obama closed countless public schools. He doubled the number of students attending charter schools. And it was Bill Clinton and the Democratic Party who gave us NAFTA, the destruction of welfare, the deregulation of the FCC, the explosion of our prison population, and the abolishment of Glass-Steagall that precipitated the global financial meltdown. Yes! Resistance will entail a personal commitment to refuse to cooperate in large and small ways with the machinery of corporate power, especially the fossil fuel industry. After all, the only safe figure for carbon emissions is zero. This will require us, as Ralph Nader has long said, to show up. We have to, as Max Weber advised, make politics a vocation. And resistance will begin locally as we transform our neighborhoods and our communities. In the conflicts I covered as a reporter in Latin America, Africa, the Middle East, and the Balkans, I encountered singular individuals of varying creeds, religions, races, and nationalities who majestically rose up to defy the oppressor on behalf of the oppressed. Some of them are dead. Some of them are forgotten. Most of them are unknown. These individuals, despite their vast cultural differences, had common traits: a profound commitment to the truth, incorruptibility, courage, a distrust of power, a hatred of violence, and a deep empathy that was extended to people who were different from them, even to people defined by the dominant culture as the enemy. They are the most remarkable men and women I met in my 20 years as a foreign correspondent. And to this day, I set my life by the standards they set. You have heard of some, such as Václav Havel, whom I and other foreign reporters met most evenings during the Velvet Revolution in Prague in 1989 at the Magic Lantern Theater. Others, no less great, you may not know, such as the Jesuit priest Ignacio Ellacuría, who was assassinated in El Salvador in 1989. And then, there are those ordinary people, although, as the writer V.S. Pritchett said, no people are ordinary, who risk their lives in wartime to shelter and protect those of an opposing religion or ethnicity who were being persecuted and hunted. And to some of these ordinary people, I owe my life. To resist radical evil is to endure a life that, by the standards of the wider society, is a failure. It is to defy injustice at the cost of your career, your reputation, your financial solvency, and at times your life. It is to be a lifelong heretic. The long, long road of sacrifice and defiance, that led to the collapse of the communist regime, stretched back decades. Those who made change possible were those who had discarded all notions of the practical. They did not try to reform the Communist Party. They did not attempt to work within the system. They did not even know what, if anything, their tiny protests, ignored by the state-controlled media, would accomplish. But through it all, they held fast to moral imperatives. They did so because these values were right and just. They expected no reward for their virtue. Indeed, they got none. They were marginalized and persecuted. And yet, these rebels, poets, playwrights, actors, singers, and writers ultimately triumphed over state and military power. They drew the good to the good. They triumphed because, however cowed and broken, the people around them appeared. Their message did not go unheard. It did not go unseen. The steady drumbeat of rebellion exposes the dead hand of authority and the rot of the state. I stood with hundreds of thousands of Czechs in 1989 on a cold winter night in Prague's Venceslas Square. As the singer Marta Kubišová approached the balcony of the Milantrik building, Kubišová had been banished from the airwaves in 1968 after the Soviet invasion for her anthem of defiance, A Prayer for Marta. Her entire catalog, including more than 200 singles, had been confiscated and destroyed. She had disappeared from public view. Her voice that night suddenly flooded the square. Pressing around me were throngs of students, most of whom had not been born when she vanished from public view. They began to sing the words of the anthem. There were tears running down their faces. It was then that I understood the power of resistance. It was then that I knew that no act of rebellion, however futile it appears in the moment, is wasted. And it was then that I knew that the communist regime was finished. The walls of Prague were covered that winter with posters of Jan Palach. Palach, a university student, set himself on fire in Venceslas Square on January 16, 1969, in the middle of the day, to protest the crushing of the country's democracy movement. He died of his burns 3 days later. The state swiftly attempted to erase his act from national memory. There was no mention of it on the state media. A funeral march by university students was broken up by the police. Palach's gravesite, which became a shrine, saw the communist authorities exhume his body, cremate his remains, and ship them to his mother with a provision that his ashes could not be placed in a cemetery. But it did not work. His sacrifice spurred the students in the winter of 1989 to act. Prague's Red Army Square, shortly after I left for Bucharest to cover the uprising in Romania, was renamed Palach Square, and 10,000 people were at the dedication. We may feel powerless, but we are not. We have a power that terrifies the corporate state. Any act of rebellion, no matter how few people show up or how heavily it is censored, chips away at corporate power. Any act of rebellion keeps alive the embers for larger movements to follow. It passes on another narrative. And it will, as the state consumes itself, attract wider and wider numbers. Perhaps this will not happen in our lifetimes, but if we persist, we keep this possibility alive, and if we do not, it will die. Revolt is a political necessity. It is a moral imperative. We must not be complicit. We must live in truth. The moment we defy power in any form, we are victorious. The moment we stand with the oppressed and accept being treated like the oppressed, we are victorious. The moment we hold up a flickering light in the darkness for others to see, we are victorious. The moment we thwart the building of a pipeline or a fracking site, we are victorious. The moment we keep a mother faced with deportation with her children, we are victorious. The moment we mass in the streets to defy police violence, we are victorious. We must turn the tide of fear. We must, by taking the streets, make the ruling elites frightened of us. To sit idle, to refuse to defy these forces, to by our silence be complicit, will atrophy and wither our souls. It will leave us husks of human beings. This is not only a fight for life. It is a fight that gives life. It is the supreme expression of faith. It is the belief that no matter how great is the power of evil, the power of love is greater. I do not, in the end, fight fascists because I will win. I fight fascists because they are fascists. Thank you.
Chris Hedges, ending his wide-ranging talk on a familiar theme. No act of rebellion against evil is ever wasted. Thanks to WWUH Radio's David Schoenfeld for acquainting me with Hedges' speech. Thanks to Robin Upton of UnwelcomeGuests.net for editing the original audio track for radio. I have condensed it further. Find us on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non-carborundum, reminding you that in solidarity there is strength, and hoping you will come back again next week. Till then.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up call.
You think you're the place to be. reason to.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear originally aired in July of 2018, but I'm replaying it now because it's a new book that I think all Americans should read. If you think that our presidents and our Congress are calling the shots, think again. The book discussed in this show reveals who the real puppet masters are. So let's begin with this show about the new book, Giants, the Global Power Elite. We're going to start the show today with some good news. Professor Peter Phillips has a new book out called Giants, the Global Power Elite, which will be released in August of 2018. This is what Mark Crispin Miller, a professor of media at NYU, has to say about the book. Peter Phillips thoroughly identifies the members of the transnational capitalist class that largely runs the world today. Through the mammoth instruments of Western military force and the international intelligence community, and not least, our free press. So there's a new global elite at the controls of our economic future, and here former Project Censor Director and Media Monitoring Sociologist Peter Phillip unveils for the general reader just who these players are. The book includes such power players as Larry Fink, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, Jamie Dimon, and Warren Buffett. And Peter Phillips names names in the book. And at the end of the book, he includes a letter to the 389 global power elites that he's named in the book. So on today's show, you're going to hear Peter Phillips, a former Project Censored director and media monitoring sociologist and professor, discuss this new book. The speech was given in March of 2018 at a conference as part of the Sonoma State University's fourth annual Social Justice Week. And it was partially sponsored by Project Censored. This video was recorded by Dennis Murphy of Petaluma Community Access. So here he is, Peter Phillips.
Okay, good afternoon. I'm Peter Phillips from the Sociology Department here at Sonoma State. And I'm going to talk about the global power elite, the giants of capitalism. And there's a picture that you all have a copy of. And this is the Diego Rivera mural, which now resides in Mexico City, but this is the second copy of it. This mural was first done at the Rockefeller Center in 1934 by Diego Rivera. And Rockefeller didn't like it that he had certain figures in there and destroyed the entire mural. The mural it's called the Man of the Universe. And it seemed appropriate that, one, the Rockefellers had destroyed it, and two, that it's, you know, about a very powerful person. And so that's going to be on the picture of my Global Power Elite book, which will be out in August from Seven Stories Press. Part of the conversation today, too, is about the transnational capitalist class. Estimates are that the world's wealth is about $255 trillion. And with U.S. and Europe holding about two-thirds of that total. Meanwhile, 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day. And the poorest half of the population lives on $2.50 a day. And 1.3 billion people live on $1.25 a day. So there's massive inequality, and 80% of the world is very poor. The LA Times reports this year that one out of nine people go to bed hungry every night. That's 795 million people on the planet who suffer from chronic hunger, and they're forecasting that 2 billion people will be lacking food by 2050. In addition, one out of three people suffer from some form of malnutrition, which means they lack sufficient vitamins and minerals in their diet that lead to health issues such as stunted growth in children. Each year, poor nutrition kills 3.1 million children under the age of five. 25,000 people a day, or 9 million a year, die from starvation and malnutrition. This slaughter occurs every day. That's the equivalent of 10 9/11 events every day in the world. Yet, we have more than enough food to feed everybody. It's not a lack of food, it's a lack of distribution. A quarter of all the food in grocery stores is thrown away. Humanity is divided into the 1%, the upper 1%, and particularly the upper 1,000th of 1%, several thousand people in the very elite group. 20%, which have jobs and incomes that are often described as middle-class working people, professionals. And the 80%, where wealth really doesn't exist at all. The transnational capital elite takes pride in pointing out that they have the largest middle class ever, but that's the 20%. But that doesn't extend down into the rest of the world, and they are getting poorer every day. Oxfam International reported in January of 2016 that only 62 people hold as much wealth as half the world. A year later, that was down to 8 people. So at the beginning of 2017, 8 people controlled more wealth than half the world. And wealth concentration is happening so massively that someday it's very feasible that one person will hold more wealth than half the humans in the world. The top billionaires, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, who's now 100 million and the number one leader in the world, Amancio Ortega from Spain, William Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Carlos Slim from Telecom in Mexico. Those are the multi-billionaires at 50 billion plus. Forbes lists 2,047 billionaires for 2017. These global capitalist elites are fully aware of their vast inequalities and their rapidly growing concentration of wealth. The billionaires are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power, yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. Understanding how power and inequality is sustained can perhaps give us opportunities for democracy and equality in today's world. Now, there's a long tradition of sociological research that documents the existence of a dominant ruling class in the United States. Elites set policy, determine national political priorities. The American upper class is complex and competitive. It perpetuates itself through interacting families of high social standing with similar lifestyles, corporate affiliations, membership in elite clubs, and private schools. The American ruling class has also long been determined to be mostly self-perpetuating, maintaining its influence through policymaking institutions such as the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Business Roundtable, the Conference Board, the American Enterprise Institute, Council of Foreign Relations, and a number of other policy groups that are U.S.-oriented. These associations have long dominated policy decisions in the U.S. government. In 1956, C. Wright Mills wrote his book called The Power Elite, which was how World War II solidified a trinity of power in the United States that comprised corporate, military, and government elites in a centralized power structure motivated by class interests and working in unison through higher circles of contact and agreement. Mills described how power elites were those who, quote, decide whatever is decided of major consequence. In the past few decades, especially since 9/11, the policy of the elites have been mostly united in support of American empire military power that maintains a repressive war against resisting groups, typically labeled terrorists, around the world. This war on terror is much more about protecting transnational globalization and capital, dollar hegemony, access to oil, than it is about repressing terrorism or protecting us. The U.S. has a long history of interventions around the globe for the purpose of protecting our national interests. Increasingly, the NATO is a partner with the U.S. in this global dominance agenda, reflecting increasing transnational economic natures of our interests. Now, when we say national interests, I think it's important to kind of specify what does that mean. Robert Blackwell, who is a Kissinger senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and national security advisor to George Bush, clearly stated in an article in January of 2017 telling President Trump the importance of defending the U.S. interests. He wrote, in addition to protecting the U.S. from nuclear threats, Blackwell called for ensuring the viability and stability of major global systems, trade, financial markets, supplies of energies, and climate. He said we must maintain a regional and global balance of power that promotes peace and stability through domestic American robustness, an international policy of primacy in supporting, defending the U.S. alliances, particularly with Israel. Now, so he's saying we're here to protect business. That's what it's about. The Heritage Foundation has an annual index called Military Strength, and it describes U.S. vital interests as defense of the homeland, successful conclusion of major wars or destabilize a region of critical interest to the U.S., and the preservation of movement within the global commons, the sea, air, and other space domains through which the world conducts business. So the empire, the American empire, and the NATO empire are about protecting business worldwide. Peter Dale Scott writes in his book, The American Deep State, he describes the importance of Wall Street as the overworld that offers intelligence agencies and personnel around the world policies and direction. The U.S. has long been the protector of global capitalism, especially since World War II. We have over 800 bases in 70 countries and territories. The U.K. and France and Russia collectively have only 30 bases that are foreign. The U.S. is now deployed in 70% of the nations in the world. And the Special Operations Command has troops in 147 countries, an 80% increase since 2010. U.S. Special Forces are currently engaged in 100 missions in Africa. Most of these missions are training exercises, but direct action counterterrorism strikes happen regularly, including drone assassination and kill and capture raids. Capital power elites exist around the world. The globalization of trade and capital brings the world elites into increasingly interconnected relationships, to the point that scholars for the past few decades have begun to talk about the development of a transnational capitalist class. One of the earliest works on this topic is the book The Transnational Capitalist Class by author Leslie Sklar, economist in London, argued that globalization has elevated transnational corporations to more influential international roles, with the result of nation-states being less significant than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations is a transnational capitalist class whose loyalties and interests are still rooted in their corporations but are increasingly international in scope. Now, deep inside the transnational class is what David Rothkopf calls, in his book, The Superclass, the global power elite in the world they are making. He is the one that talks about the 1,000th of 1%, the 6,000 to 7,000 people who the Davos-attending, private jet-flying, mega-corporation-interlocked, policy-planning elites of the world, people at the absolute peak of the global power pyramid. They are predominantly white, mostly from North America and Europe, and they are the ones that set the agendas in the G20, the G7, NATO, the World Bank, and the WTO, World Trade Organization. Now, in our research, we identify the people on the boards of directors of the top 17 asset management firms of the world. These firms have in excess of $1 trillion in management. These 17 firms collectively have 199 directors on their boards. We think that this group of 199 individuals represents the financial core of the world's transnational capitalist class. Now, if you look at the chart on the back of the picture I gave you, that's the back of the cover image. There's a chart there that shows you what we call the giants. When I say giants, these are the corporations that managed in excess of $1 trillion in 2017. So many of them are far in excess. They're $4 trillion, $5 trillion, $4 trillion, $3 trillion. And the total for those 17 firms is $41.1 trillion. They're only managed by 199 people, so a room twice the size they could all fit in and have cocktails. It's not very many. And what's interesting about these, They're the Western governments and policy boards work in the interest of this financial core to protect the free flow of capital investment anywhere in the world and the continuing returns needed for capital growth. The financial core of the transnational class are the directors of banks and the asset firms that control this $41 trillion. In addition, they also serve many other smaller asset management firms, adding traditional trillions of dollars and more. So if you look at the chart I gave you, it shows you the one with all the squiggly lines, the global giants corporations. Those are the 17, and they control $41 trillion, and they're all invested in each other. So the $41 trillion, $403 billion, is invested in each other. So they're all collectively invested in that this $40 trillion becomes one large, super-connected global capital structure managed by less than 200 people. And that's the power of elites today. Now, if you look at the backside of that chart, you'll see that the $17 trillion companies, there's three more new giants that by 2018, have been added into the trillionaires. And then there's nine near giants who are all in excess of $800 billion. So if you put those all together, we're talking about 30 big companies that control in excess of $50 trillion worth of wealth. So we're starting to talk about a quarter of all the wealth in the world concentrated in one place. Now, if you try to think about $1 trillion, I mean, it's really kind of an amazing thing to even think about. The entire U.S. military empire and NATO together, all the bases around the world, all the military wars and things we're doing, does not exceed $1 trillion. So when you talk about 50 times that, managed by just a few hundred people, it's a massive amount of very solid consolidated wealth that every government institution, every president of European countries, all the intelligence agencies want to protect. That's what American capitalism is about, is protecting that wealth. The top asset firms tend to invest in each other. J.P. Morgan, Chase, and BlackRock, they have this $403 billion invested collectively in each other. The interlock capital is likely much higher. It's probably closer to $2 to $3 trillion because that $400 billion that we've discovered was only about 25% that NASDAQ publicly lists in terms of co-investments. So 75% of these investments are held privately, and we don't know where they are. So there are many hundreds of transnational capitalist people inside the global empire of capital, but these are the 199 that are the most part of the financial core. They manage the top 17 firms. They have similar backgrounds and similar training. The 136 of them, they're all degreed. 59 have MBAs or PhDs. Almost all attended elite colleges. 28 attended Harvard and Stanford. The people from the 20 nations are made up the financial core. 60% are from the U.S. 23 are from Britain and France each. 13 from Germany and Switzerland each. Then 3 from Italy, Singapore, India, Austria. 2 from Japan and Brazil. And then 1 each from Netherlands, South Africa, Zambia, Kuwait, Belgium, Canada, Mexico, Colombia. So it's international. And they all operate in the big cities like New York, Chicago, London, Paris, Munich, or went to college there, Tokyo, Singapore. The members of the financial core take active part in global policy groups. Financial core serve on as advisors to the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, International Bank of Settlements, the Federal Reserve Board, the G7, and the G20. Most attend the World Economic Forum in Davos. Many of the 199 have been keynote speakers there. So the World Economic Forum has been getting more attention. That we, newspapers will say when it's happening. It's not a policy-making body. It's in Davos, Switzerland, January of every year. 2,000 or 3,000 people go. It's up at 5,000-foot elevation. They pay. This year, I heard it was 50,000. It used to be 25,000. And the top 1,000 corporations in the world are invited to send people. And they can send as many as 5, as long as one is a woman. So that's how they keep a little gender balance there. So, but it's not a formal policy-making group. There's an educational consensus function, where these thousands of elites in the world, 3,000 attended in 2017, they're getting to hear from top investors and top policy people in the world. The president of China was there last year. And didn't Trump go this year? I think he did. And so it's very personally, it's very enlightenment. And, you know, a lot of feeling of, boy, I'm really special because I'm here. I'm in Davos. Kind of the same thing I saw at the Bohemian Grove, where the 2,000-plus men meet every year. And it's just all men there. They don't even have a quota for women. But they don't make policy either. They just get together, applaud each other, hear talks and speeches, and feel good about it all. Transnational elites interact as a class of people. They know each other often personally. They do business together. And they either know each other personally or know of each other. They have similar educational and lifestyle backgrounds. They share common global interests. They meet in non-governmental policy organizations and form new ones as needs arise to privately make decisions for global governance institutions to implement. Transnational elites hold a common ideology of being the engineers of global capitalism, a firm belief that their way of life and continuing global capital is best for all humankind. The transnational capitalist class represents the interests of several hundred thousand millionaires and billionaires who comprise the richest people in the top 1% of the world's hierarchy. So you may be a multimillionaire, but most of your money you've allowed a management investment firm to hold for you and give you anywhere from a 3 to 10% return. And if you have some that's risky, you may go with a venture capitalist company in the hopes of getting better than a 10% return. Ironically, this extreme accumulation of concentrated capital creates a continuing problem for investors. They have to scour the world for new investment opportunities that will not yield adequate return, that will yield adequate returns on capital. So they got more capital, they got places to invest it in with a positive return. So the concentration of wealth and power at this level tends to overaccumulate in the hands of increasingly fewer elites to the point that capital has limited safe investment opportunities. There's three mechanisms for investing this excess capital. One, they'll do risky financial speculations like the subprime mortgage loans, which almost collapsed the entire system in 2008. They will continually buy up public institutions and try to privatize everything, electric companies, water, roads, schools. I'm waiting for churches to become privatized. Well, in some ways they are. So everything that's part of the public domain, everything in the culture is for sale. And the other big area where capital is used up is the preparation for war and the acting and wars. So wars, they spend huge amounts of money investing in war machines, war protection, armies, and then they blow things up that have to be reinvested and protected. So it's a very great profitable way to use capital. So Western governments and international policy bodies serve the interest of the transnational capital class, capital concentrations. Wars are initiated to protect their interests. Uncooperative regimes are undermined and overthrown in support of the free flow of global capital for investment anywhere the returns are possible. So we've seen regime changes and attempted regime changes in Libya, Iraq, Syria, Venezuela, Yemen, Afghanistan, the Balkans are all examples of wars to support international capital penetration of the region. There were some blockages before by dictators or government blockages, and that they're seeking to undermine that. And they're seeking very hard to dismantle the democratically elected countries in Venezuela and Cuba, for that matter. And earmarking and surrounding militarily China and Russia. Now, the Chinese have some 80 billionaires, and they are invested in this market, and they are part of the policy planning thing, but they still maintain separate military and nationalistic orientations that the power elite don't like very much. So while millions suffer, the power elites, the financials, they focus on seeking returns in the trillions of dollars, and they'll do this on speculating everything, like food and land. So, and they'll cooperate with each other to control and entrap, and this controls and traps cycles of economic growth with continuing mass humanitarian consequences. So if they're investing in bulk foods, the commodities market, and the prices are going up, for somebody living on $2 a day and the price of whatever commodity they're eating, rice, potatoes, whatever, goes up, that leads to the continuing starvation of tens of thousands of people every day. So war and preparation for war is a major return use of excess capital. For the U.S., that amounts to $600 billion in 2017. It's higher this year. China is $215 billion, Russia $69 billion, but Saudi Arabia, U.K., India, France, Japan, Germany are all in the $40, $50 billion range. South Korea, Italy, Australia, Brazil, Israel are all in the $20 to $30 billion range. So Dwight Eisenhower said in 1953, every gun that's made, every warship launched, every rocket fired signifies, in the final sense, a theft from those who are hungry and are not fed, and those who are cold and not clothed.
And again, you were just listening to Peter Phillips discussing his new book, Giant, The Global Power Elite, coming out in August of 2018. You can pre-order a copy at the website projectcensored.org. And again, that's projectcensored.org. And tune in next week to hear the second and final part of this speech. And just a reminder that my shows are archived at the website radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And once on the site, click on Contributors, and then look for Cheryl with a C. And then if you click on my name, the show should pop up in chronological order. And today's show should be up there in a few days. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Queens residents are outraged over Amazon's HQ2 plan to turn Long Island City into a company town.
I think that was a question mark, or is that an exclamation point? We'll find out when we speak later on. I assume it's an exclamation point. And now we're heading to Long Island City, where Mr. Jeff Bezos thinks that the city should be rolling out the red carpet for him. And my goodness, I guess they did. But people have other things in mind.
Introduce our state senator, Mike Gianaris.
Thank you. This is a bad deal. The state and the city should both be embarrassed to be standing behind this deal. Yeah. They got taken. Amazon pitted everyone against each other, and guess what? They ended up in the two places everybody knew they were going to end up in anyway. The only difference is we're out $3 billion here in New York. We are not stopping. We are just beginning. We will go to court. We will take legislative action. But they are clearly trying very hard to give the people of New York virtually no say about this whole deal.
That's right.
Think about how crazy this is. A private company forced the government to sign a secrecy agreement and not tell its own people what it was doing with its money.
Right.
Now that they're actually announced the deal, they want to make sure the city council doesn't get to vote on it. They want to make sure the state legislature doesn't get to vote on it. But we're here to say that is unacceptable. The people have a right to be heard on this issue, and this is their community.
This is a democracy.
The subways are in crisis. We don't have enough public school seats. The rents are going through the roof in Long Island City. And just yesterday, just because this deal was announced, the predatory speculators came to town and started buying up apartments by text message without even seeing the apartments. The infrastructure of Long Island City is already being stretched to its limits. This is a community that's bursting at the seams. Good people that have made Long Island City so great that Jeff Bezos wants to come here are being priced out of their own homes. We have just begun to fight. Strap yourselves in and get ready. We are not giving up until we scuttle this deal, scrap it, throw it in the garbage, and start the conversation all over again.
Yeah. Please welcome Assemblywoman Arabella Simotas.
Thank you. The truth is, this deal stinks. Honesty and fair dealing really require that you don't secretly give the richest man on earth all of these subsidies. We don't even know how much we're talking about. Clearly, we have to make sure that we invest in our infrastructure, invest in our schools, invest in the working people of this community who made Long Island City what it is today. I am here to fight with you because really, again, this deal stinks.
Thank you,
Arabella.
I'd like to introduce to you Deborah Axe, the executive director of Make the Run New York. What we're talking about here is lining the pockets of the richest man in the history of the world with the money that our communities have contributed to our tax base. Not to mention his active partnerships with ICE, the Department of Defense. Amazon is partnering to deport our community members and destroy our jobs. This is the moment when we need to stand up and say, enough is enough.
Thank you, Deborah. And we are going to do whatever it takes to stop this process and make Amazon feel it. Just this morning, I took out my phone. I deleted the Amazon app off my phone. And I will no longer be purchasing from Amazon.
Yeah. Boycott.
Hashtag boycott Amazon. If people want to join in, let's make that happen.
Daniel Gross from Brand Workers.
Daniel Gross.
We're a nonprofit membership organization of the workers, mostly Latino, Asian, African American, who report to work in the food factories of New York City. We are right now in the heart of a historic and present-day neighborhood for the manufacture of food. Local food manufacturing means the potential of good jobs for marginalized communities. Brand Workers members make fresh food, wholesome, artisan bread, hummus, fresh-cut vegetables. We desperately need industrial space so Brand Workers members can go to work. New Jersey, others are competing aggressively to take our food manufacturing jobs away. Amazon here will decimate food manufacturing in the neighborhood of Long Island City and surrounding areas.
Aquí estamos y no nos vamos. Aquí estamos y no nos vamos.
Well, that was not the first, but one of the first demonstrations in Long Island City, and I dare say there's probably something similar in Crystal City. As we talk about Queens, residents are outraged over Amazon HQ2 plan to turn Long Island City into, I think, a company town.
And our guest, we welcome R. Mirza Silva-Faro, who's the executive director of Align, Alliance for a Greater New York, and Greg LeRoy, who's the executive director of Good Jobs First. Greg, let's just start first in terms of the proposals themselves. What is being given to Amazon by the city and the state? I know you can probably go on for a year about this.
Can you? because do we yet know? That's one of the real catastrophes of all of this.
We know some of it. And great to be with you, Ken and Mimi, and hi, Maritza. So
hi.
We know of at least $2.8 billion, almost $3 billion, as the Assemblyman said, of subsidies that are already greased by the Cuomo administration and by automatic subsidies from the city that this deal is slated to qualify for. That adds up to about $112,000 plus per job, which is a very expensive deal. And, you know, so that's the problem. And as many of the speakers said, and I'm so glad you said that, you know, this is a company that doesn't deserve or need any subsidies. This is a company already growing rapidly. This is a company that's already gotten huge tax breaks from many data centers, many of its warehouses. We've documented $1.6 billion in subsidies already for projects it has to build, right? It has to have warehouses to deliver all those prime deliveries so rapidly. It has to have data centers to be the biggest cloud computing company in the world. And it's got to have more headquarters because it's growing and it's bursting at the seams in Seattle, and they want access to other labor markets. So this is an example of your state and city paying a juggernaut company and the wealthiest man in the world to do what they had to do otherwise.
I can't help but say, when you say the wealthiest man in the world, you know, the company itself, right? The company itself is, it surpassed Microsoft in right. 2018 in February, making it the world's third most valuable company, and Jeff Bezos, who has 78.9 million shares of Amazon stock, is the richest man of all time with an estimated net worth of $105 billion. Why isn't he paying into our coffers, Maritza?
Hello, Greg, Mimi, and also Ken. Thank you so much for having me on your show. This is moment actually reminds me a little bit during the times of the Walmart fight. You all were on it as well, covering and also listening about like how Walmart was creating these labor standards back then. And it is sort of a repetition in terms of thinking about these kind of companies, as Amazon is, that corporate bully. Basically, they just want to come into our communities with no accountability. They have practices where there has been so many issues around worker protections for workers across the country and across the globe, really. So this is the kind of company that makes it so that if they feel entitled. And it is unfortunate that our governor and our mayor have no actually made the right calculation here. Instead of standing on the side of workers, excuse me.
See, Maritza's been going to too many demonstrations. Her voice.
I think she was in a marathon meeting before this talk.
I'm sure she was in. That's what Maritza does. Should we let you grab a glass of water?
Yeah, let me come back.
Okay, we're going to pick it up with Greg.
Greg, you had mentioned at the end of when you asked you that they would have come here anyway. Do you really believe that? Come here in Virginia? Do they have to create this nationwide search of all over the country, cities and states, begging them to come there and raising all this money to bring them? Do they want to be here? And then why should we want them?
Well, I do believe, and I've said many times, that I think Amazon knew what the short list of possible locations was before they ever created this public auction. And I think the purpose of the public auction was just to create pressure for more tax breaks from its final choices. And the $4 billion that we can already identify in the two locations makes this the fourth biggest single economic development tax break deal in U.S. history. It'll probably end up being the third biggest because of the Foxconn deal in Wisconsin that's basically melting down. So it really looks like a cynical exercise. You know, when we know that they encouraged Virginia Beach and Frisco, Texas, and, you know, Calgary and all these other places that clearly never had a prayer to submit bids and to spend all this time and all this money on bids that never had a chance, it looks like a very cynical exercise.
I want to just also ask you, Greg, and hope that Maritza has recuperated a little bit. For me, the question, this dangling, this prospect, what a lovely prospect, of 25,000 jobs. And what I had said to you, Greg, when we spoke previously was Queensbridge Housing Project, the largest project in the country, which has a desperate need for jobs for its residents. It is highly unlikely. There is very, very little likelihood that any of the people there or in the surrounding communities will wind up getting any of those jobs. There's certainly no training programs to put them into those jobs, and the jobs that might be created in terms of construction are largely unavailable because of the shape of the unions and getting one's license and so on and so forth. They're not part of that structure, and they're not going to wind up with those construction jobs either. So I'm interested in what your experience has been about the realization of jobs for community there. And Maritza, yourself as well. And then we can, of course, talk about what's going to happen to the housing prices and all the rest and the gentrification. But Greg, Maritza?
Well, I'll defer to Maritza mostly. I mean, mainly, let's remember, this is a headquarters, a corporate headquarters. So most of the jobs are going to be white-collar jobs. They're going to be hiring lawyers and CPAs and marketing specialists and software engineers. I'm not thinking there's too many candidates for those jobs living in the public housing project. So the question is, how many of the support jobs and janitorial and security jobs could be staffed by residents from that area?
So we know that Amazon will do far more harm than good for workers and communities in New York City. We know that because Amazon has a history of dragging workers down, not lifting them up. Right? We've seen that in the warehouses. Right now we know that there's a couple of them that are expanding in New York. And Greg is right, that most of those jobs in this particular headquarters are going to be jobs for folks who are not going to be able to access. So, I mean, to me, the problem here is that we are giving so much subsidies away to one of the wealthiest corporations in the planet, but also we are allowing for this company to perhaps do what is already happening in our city, is that gentrification of our communities in terms of housing already happening. We experienced this in Long Island City, and now what we're going to see with Amazon is the expansion of the gentrification of our housing in the neighborhood overall, but also the gentrification of jobs. So we also have to learn about what happened in Seattle, what's happening in Silicon Valley, and how when there is no enough of support for community folks to be able to access to these kind of jobs, we are only, you know, having these amazing talking points of 25,000 jobs as like this great deal that we're doing for our communities. And it's still that trickle-down economy concept has not been functioning or has not been helpful for our communities and for our city. Back in the day, we were with Greg and others working closely on looking at the all of the subsidies at the state level because they have been given to many corporations that do not create the jobs for our community members, rather create poverty. So there is no reason to think that things will be different with Amazon right now.
Maritza, am I hearing right? Are you basically saying that we don't want Amazon to come in? Because that's my position in any event, that it will cause more harm than good. The subsidies be damned. Even if they say, forget the subsidies, we want to come into that area. Do we want them there?
No, we don't. We don't want this kind of company in our city. I can just tell you that, you know, New York City progressive values don't match up with Amazon's values, no matter how many times the mayor wants to say that. The reality is not the case. Like right now, I'm meeting with many people. That's why I lost my voice, actually, essentially, from the progressive movement and beyond, who are outraged about this problem. And the reality is that people are going to stand up. People are going to be asking about what is actually needed in our communities. And what we need at the end of the day is investment from the taxpayers' money, already giving the money to be able to invest in housing, in real job creation, workforce development, that we can be giving to our neighborhoods rather than giving it to this company. We can be doing those things. That's one thing that I want to share. The other piece is that this agreement that the governor and the mayor just talked about so much as a great thing, it's not even binding. Right, it's just an MOU, and who knows, you know, what Amazon will do later on. It's just something that we might not be able to ever hold them accountable to. And we have to be very wary and careful. And the governor and the mayor actually did not think about any of the things that the communities are experiencing today.
And we're speaking with Maritza Silva-Farrell, Executive Director of Alliance for Greater New York, and Greg LeRoy, Executive Director for Good Jobs First. And you've been studying these issues. So, Greg, put some more meat on the bone, because I was actually in the pizzeria in my neighborhood when I first heard and saw an interview with Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio saying, we are giving goose eggs, we are giving nothing to Amazon, nothing of the city coffers there, and we are going to get 25,000 jobs. So while Ken and Maritza might say, snap, goodbye, Amazon, I know that there's still considerable amounts of the public are saying, what are you talking about? We can force them to do job training and stuff for the local residents, and then we wind up with $100,000 job. What's wrong with that?
Well, you know, I'm struck by how you spoke about that. I hope this day doesn't become like 10 years later people can say, I remember where I was when I heard the news, the terrible news.
Very good pizza, I should say. The TV was on.
1 o'clock in the pizza shop where you heard that.
Yeah. So,
well,
look,
Smiling Pizzeria, it's really good.
The idea that your mayor could stand up and saying he's giving nothing to the company is just pure baloney. Right, there's two enormous programs that are what we call as-of-right programs. That is, they are automatic programs, one big property tax abatement program especially, and another sort of tax rebate program that are together worth almost $1.3 billion for a deal this size if they hire that many people. And I think that these programs were never intended to be kind of giant, open-ended, you know, ATMs for companies coming into New York. I think they should be capped. They should never be allowed to pay out that much money for one single project. And, you know, the amount of money embedded in those two subsidies is worth almost as much as is coming from the state, you know, from the Cuomo administration. This is absolutely a co-bankrupt deal by the city and the state. Don't kid yourselves.
And have you experienced, what has been your experience in other venues to help us take from that and understand what the potential is for people who are harder to convince that this is not good for Long Island City. It's not good for Crystal City. It's not good for working people.
Well, I think the it's about education, right? It's about making sure people understand that there was a lot of apples and oranges and bologna getting cut on the day this deal was announced.
Salami.
Right? So, for example, the Amazon press release referred to $48,000 in subsidies per job, but they were cherry-picking, right? They were taking only one of the three big pots of money when they made that calculation. And in the same sentence, then they juxtapose $150,000 average salary as if to suggest that 48 could be compared to 150. But, of course, it can't be compared. These are apples and oranges. Right? $48,000 is taxpayer money out. $150,000 is a private salary. Only a tiny portion of that will get paid in taxes to offset the $48,000. It was deliberately written to suggest that taxpayers were going to get rich, that they were going to get a 3-to-1 return, when nothing of the sort is true.
Maritza, I wanted to ask you about the meeting in which you lost your voice. Okay. I wanted to ask you about what was being discussed there, because I know that was about further actions. I know a number of different groups independently are doing things, but what is the coalition that held the demonstration last week? Who are they, and what's next up?
I mean, you will see soon enough, and we'll definitely notify you when we are ready to. But a lot of discussions has happened, and folks are very concerned. There are serious questions remaining about this deal and what it actually means to the city. And what Greg just said is totally right. It requires a little bit of education to ensure that we all understand that it has not been any, there is no privilege for us to have Amazon coming to Long Island City. So we have had some conversations. We will, announce a few things that we will be doing soon enough. We'll talk soon about it. Not ready to just share details at this point. But one thing I will say is that large amount of people are coming together from all corners of the city to oppose this deal in big numbers.
Let me ask you this. We don't want to alert the police to exactly what coordinates where we're all going to be at this point. We'll call that breaking news when it breaks. But what I do want to know is, to what extent have any of the public officials now said that, aside from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, right on, but are there others who are on board with the community? And then I just want to ask Greg, in his experience, where are they going as good jobs first?
So in terms of other elected officials, I mean, you already have seen at the press conference that we had last week, Council Member Jimmy Van Bramer has been outspoken about not only about the millions of dollars or billions of dollars, rather, that we are trying to give to this company, maybe the governor actually trying to give to the company, but also about the process itself, right? We're talking also about a level of accountability where the city council has been left completely in the dark in terms of how these decisions were made. And, of course, council members are really outraged about that as well. Similarly, with Senator Gennaris, those are the two people who represent the area and have been very outspoken in the press in opposition to what's been happening with Amazon. But, yeah, transparency is one of the main points that I've been hearing a lot. I just want to touch on one more thing before we move on to the other piece that I think it's really critical to just emphasize to the question that you ask in relation to, like, okay, so but other people think that there could be 25,000 jobs coming into our city. That sounds like a good thing. Well, I think what folks might not realize, if people who might think and are hopeful, rightly so, to just like say a company as big as Amazon is bringing some jobs and maybe my kid can get into the tech industry and that's the future, right? So there's hope, and I think that's right. The problem is that we actually experienced not too long ago how this company bullied in a terrible way to their own home in Seattle. Right, the location of Amazon in Seattle and the headquarters there really made it so that the entire community got destroyed. So I think people need to understand about what it means to bring this kind of monopoly into a city
and
that is mostly a small business owners, you know, controlled, but community engagement. So our city is going to completely change.
Maritza, let me just stop you long enough to get in because we're going to keep on top of this with a line. But I want Greg to get in the last word since what is to be done? What's happening with Good Jobs First since you've got Crystal City and you've been looking at the whole country? And we got about 1 minute.
Sure. So we've been very actively working with the people in New York and with the people in Northern Virginia, and they are communicating with each other and learning from each other. But we're also very concerned about the other 235 cities whose bids weren't taken up, and we're urging them to all disclose. Everybody must disclose their bids. Now, they were not covered by non-disclosure agreements. We know already that Pittsburgh's deal was bigger than any that was known. It was $9.7 billion. We know that Toronto's bid, which got disclosed early, has become a big, successful economic development magnet calling card for that city. We suspect there's lots of other crazy stuff in some of these bids, and we certainly, at the end of the day, we don't want Jeff Bezos to own and monetize this data. And the only way we can prevent that is by getting it into the public domain.
And you will find out by continuing to listen to Building Bridges what Maritza has up her sleeve for protest and what the whole city has to be up in arms about. We want to thank Maritza Silva Farrell, Executive Director of Alliance for a Greater New York, and Greg LeRoy, Executive Director of Good Jobs First, which is what we want, Good Jobs First. And we'll keep on close watch on this very critical issue. Take that, Jeff Bezos. Thank you both for joining us. And we're going to go out with White Man in a Business Suit. How appropriate.
This is for all you big government Wall Street types.
Well, I was watching TV at election time. There were two candidates trying to lay it on the line. One of them looked like he was training to be cute. He was a white man in a business suit. I looked at the other. He was equally astute. He was a white man in a business suit. Well, they kept on talking. They didn't make sense. They both seemed to be on the same side of the fence. There was no real debate, it was a phony dispute. They were just two white men in business suits. If you want to be the president, better learn to salute and be a white man in a business suit. He's a white man in a business suit. If a single one of them are in cahoots, he's running the U.S., Europe, and Russia too. He's a white man in a business suit.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
This Way Out.
And care about people who are different than us. We can embrace difference while seeking common ground.
She spoke out then.
I believe.
She's speaking now.
I believe.
I still believe.
I believe her.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappelle. Caribbean Justice Court quashes Guyana's anti-trans law, rainbow candidates surf the U.S. blue wave, and melody and policy ignite Emma's revolution. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Anique Lukens.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending November 17th, 2018. The Caribbean Court of Justice has overturned a law in Guyana that targeted transgender people. The ruling this week declared as unconstitutional the small South American nation's law criminalizing men and women for dressing in clothing of the opposite sex for an improper purpose. The court has jurisdiction over several Caribbean and South American countries. Noting that Guyana's constitution protects its people from discrimination and states that no one is to be treated in a discriminatory manner by any public office or authority, justices struck down that part of the colonial-era British Penal Code that dates back to 1893. The ruling called the law vague, that was from a different time and no longer served any legitimate purpose. The plaintiffs in the case were four transgender women who were arrested in 2009 for cross-dressing in public. The appeal to the Caribbean Court of Justice challenged their conviction by a magistrate who fined them the equivalent of about $100 and ordered them to go to church and give their lives to Jesus Christ. Private consensual adult same-gender sex is against the law and carries a sentence of up to life in prison in Guyana. It's the only country in South America to maintain that part of its antiquated penal code. The first ever LGBTQ pride parade was held in June in Georgetown, the country's capital. The favorable ruling has now sparked equality activists to call on lawmakers in Guyana to repeal all the nation's anti-queer laws.
The Constitutional Chamber of Costa Rica's Supreme Court of Justice struck down the Central American nation's denial of civil marriage to same-gender couples in August, but delayed its ruling from coming into force until after it was officially published. The ruling was a direct result of the decision in January of this year by the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ordering all signatories to the American Convention on Human Rights to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. Rulings by the Inter-American Court are binding on 20 nations in the region. A few have already enacted marriage equality, but most have not. Although President Carlos Alvarado submitted a marriage equality proposal to Costa Rica's Legislative Assembly, its leadership has refused to take up the issue. The country's high court decision was finally published on November 14th. It now gives lawmakers up to 18 months to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. If there's no action by May 2020, the court ruled, same-gender couples will automatically be allowed to start planning their weddings. In their 287-page ruling, justices said that acts of open discrimination, whether they are expressed or implied, cannot be justified in any way in a democratic society that respects fundamental rights. Enrique Sanchez, the country's first openly gay legislator, accuses the Legislative Assembly's leadership of intentionally delaying debate. According to Pink News, evangelical anti-LGBTQ members hold 14 of the chamber's 57 seats.
Tanzania is paying a heavy price for its oppressive treatment of sexual minorities and pregnant schoolgirls. The East African nation's second biggest donor, Denmark, announced that it was withholding the equivalent of about $10 million in aid soon after Dar es Salaam Governor Paul Makonda ordered the arrest of anyone in the region perceived to be homosexual. Tanzania's foreign ministry tried to distance itself from the crackdown, but queer panic quickly spread across the country. The U.S. issued a warning to Americans in the country to be careful what they post on social media, and the European Union withdrew its ambassador. While acknowledging that the loss of financial aid will affect LGBTQ Tanzanians too, Judy Kato, a lawyer with the advocacy group Equality Now, told Reuters that the government has not been receptive to any type of dialogue over the issue of sexual minorities. And now the World Bank has frozen a $300 million education loan to Tanzania over a long-standing policy that bans pregnant girls, the government calls immoral, from attending school, among other human rights concerns. While a law punishing gay sex is rarely enforced in Tanzania, its mere existence fosters anti-queer bias and violence. Pro-equality groups have been shut down, and activists have been arrested. Government authorities have also stopped HIV/AIDS prevention programs for gay men.
Pioneering U.S. activist Harry Hay used to say that queer people are society's trailblazers. A group of about 80 LGBTQ people fleeing persecution is the first from what Donald Trump and his allies have called an invasion to reach the Mexico-U.S. border. They include a baby, two toddlers, and a 12-year-old. They broke away from the migrant caravan that's been traveling through Central America and into Mexico the past few weeks after encountering anti-queer harassment from their fellow asylum seekers. They arrived in the border town of Tijuana this week after gaining support from LGBTQ rights groups to supplement the money they were able to put together for buses to carry them along the last stretch of their journey. The Washington Post reported that they celebrated their arrival by waving rainbow flags and blasting music by Ariana Grande. The queer refugees had enough money between them to rent modest local accommodations in Tijuana while contemplating their next moves. One government official said that the wait for the chance to apply for asylum at nearby San Diego's San Ysidro port of entry is up to 18 months. Sadly, they're already facing anti-queer animus from Tijuana's mayor and some of their neighbors. Cesar Mejia, a 23-year-old Honduran man, told the Spanish news agency EFE that he had to flee his homeland because he had been repeatedly beaten by gang members for being gay. In addition to Honduras, most of the other LGBTQ asylum seekers have fled persecution, poverty, and violence based on their sexual orientation or gender identity in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua.
And finally, as we record this newscast amidst the whirlwind that is the Trump administration, a twice-failed Republican candidate in Iowa, who's targeted in an FBI fraud investigation, is still the acting Attorney General of the United States. The president replaced one dyed-in-the-wool homophobe, Jeff Sessions, with another, a former U.S. attorney for Iowa named Matthew Whitaker, the day after the rainbow-hued blue wave midterm election swept Democrats into the House majority. As U.S. attorney in 2007, Whitaker brought a politically motivated federal prosecution against Matt McCoy, a rising star in the Democratic Party and Iowa's first openly gay state senator. The case eventually fell apart amid allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, and McCoy was acquitted of extorting a former business partner. But his life in elective politics was over. Judicial appointments and cabinet-level appointments like attorney general require Senate confirmation. Here's Whitaker during a 2014 conservative forum as candidate for his state's Republican U.S. Senate nomination, describing what he'd look for in a federal judge.
What I'd like to see is I'd like to see things like their worldview, what informs them, how have they lived their lives, are they people of faith, do they have a biblical view of justice, and if they have a secular worldview where this is all we have here on earth, then I'm going to be very concerned about how they judge.
Are you wondering why the president didn't replace the forced-to-resign Jeff Sessions with a logical next-in-command? Deputy Attorney General Ron Rosenstein, who's overseeing the Mueller investigation? Matthew Whitaker, Jeff Sessions' former chief of staff, has echoed Donald Trump's description of the probe as an unlawful witch hunt.
Whitaker served on the board and often did legal work for a Miami-based company called World Patent Marketing. Time travel, hot tubs, and a toilet for well-endowed men were among its claims to fame. The company allegedly targeted veterans, among other vulnerable people, claiming to help them patent their inventions, which the company failed to do. Whitaker and his associates are under federal investigation for fraud. But he went home to Iowa this week for his first public appearance since Trump named him acting attorney general and displayed amazing chutzpah when he told his audience of legal professionals,
"We're going to keep putting fraudsters in jail. All of us can be on the lookout for fraud schemes and report suspected criminal activity."
A number of lawsuits have already been filed challenging Trump's ability to appoint the legal shill as acting attorney general, whom one legal scholar described as having the least qualifying credentials to be a U.S. attorney, let alone attorney general. The soon-to-be Democratic House majority, which officially doesn't take power until early January, is already planning to haul Whitaker before a number of congressional committees to respond to numerous charges that he's unqualified, a stooge for Donald Trump, and, as the Constitution requires, he's never been vetted in or confirmed by the Senate to hold the post of Attorney General. This is all assuming, of course, that Whitaker is still the acting Attorney General of the United States next week, next month, or next year.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending November 17th, 2018. Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap is written by Greg Gordon, produced with Brian DeShazer, recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles, and brought to you by you.
Help keep us in ears around the world at the always updating thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Anique Lukens.
Peace, salam, shalom. Peace, salam, shalom.
No peace without justice or music. Steve Sims focuses on a revolution in song later in the program.
Be true to you. Be proud. Be strong. 'Cause love's never wrong.
Hi, this is Barbara Streisand. Tuesday is a critical election for LGBTQ people and all marginalized communities. And I'm working with GLAAD to help ensure the largest turnout ever of LGBTQ and ally voters in a midterm election. I hope you will join me at the polls to send a strong message that America is better when we stand together.
Election day in the U.S. has turned into election month as delayed results, recounts, and runoffs continue, still trying to determine the winners of the remaining too-close-to-call midterm contests. The number of tight races is one proof that the passionate get-out-the-vote campaigns featuring stars like Barbara Streisand really worked. Record-breaking turnout fulfilled the Democratic Party's dream of a blue wave across the country, and LGBTQ voters, over 80% of them, helped sweep Democratic candidates into office. A record number of LGBTQ candidates rode the blue wave to victory. We heard from several of them last week. Add to them the reelected bisexual Oregon Governor Kate Brown.
This election shows that when our values are on the ballot, Oregonians will come together and fight like hell to stand up for what we believe in. Tonight, we can say we fought to keep Oregon a welcoming and inclusive place for all. We fought to make sure that every woman in this state, regardless of their income, regardless of their zip code, and regardless of their immigration status, will have access to the full complement of reproductive health services. Thank you.
Several queer candidates achieved notable firsts. Jennifer Webb is the first out lesbian elected to the Florida legislature. Josh Tenorio becomes Guam's lieutenant governor, the U.S. territory's first out gay executive. Tenorio ran with Lou Leon Guerrero, who becomes the island's first woman governor. 27-year-old Malcolm Kenyatta was elected Pennsylvania's second openly gay member of the state house. He's also the first black gay man elected to statewide office and joins reelected gay incumbent Brian Sims. Megan Hunt is the first openly LGBTQ person ever elected to the Nebraska state legislature, Former Marine Neil Rafferty beat his Republican opponent by almost 9-1 to be the first openly gay man elected to the Alabama state legislature.
I'm running for this seat because I will never forget how it feels to be excluded and how hard we had to work to get a seat at the table. I'm running for this seat to fight for your family the same way that I fought for mine.
Do you remember the viral video of the 19-year-old who argued for his lesbian mom's right to marry before the Iowa legislature? Zach Walls is now going back there as a newly elected Democratic state senator who beat his libertarian opponent by more than 50 points. Walls was among hundreds of young candidates motivated to run for public office in the wake of the 2016 presidential election. An all-blue delegation will even be going to the U.S. House from California's infamous Orange County, the deep red home of many anti-queer, anti-minority politicians and ballot initiatives. In the usually conservative northern part of Los Angeles County, blue bisexual Katie Hill unseated entrenched far-right GOP congressional homophobe Steve Knight. Another one of those long, narrow vote counts has finally resulted in Arizona declaring Kristen Sinema its new U.S. senator, the first out bisexual in the U.S. Senate.
Arizona rejected what has become far too common in our country: name-calling, petty personal attacks, and doing and saying whatever it takes just to get elected. It's dangerous, and it lessens who we are as a country. But we can work with people who are different than us. We can be friends with people who are different than us. We can love and care about people who are different than us. We can keep people who are different than us safe. We can be good people who care deeply about each other, even when we disagree. We can try to understand another person's life experiences and perspective. We can try to imagine what another person's life might be like, that perhaps her experiences have shaped her life, just like our experiences have shaped ours. We can embrace difference while seeking common ground.
More than 150 LGBTQ Victory Fund candidates won office from sea to shining sea, more than in any previous election, and the first keep rolling in. Gabriel Acevedo, the first gay Afro-Latino in the Maryland General Assembly. Sonia Yaquez Lewis, the first queer Latina in the Colorado State Legislature. Brandon Woodard and Susan Ruiz, the first out members of the Kansas House of Representatives. California State Insurance Commissioner-elect Ricardo Lara and North Carolina Appeals Court Judge-elect John Arrowwood, the first out gay men to win statewide election in their states. And Florida has its first all-LGBTQ city commission, thanks to the voters of Wilton Manors. Some Republican losses were equally telling. Ron Simmons was routed in his reelection bid after sponsoring an anti-trans bathroom bill in the Texas legislature. Gays for Trump leader Peter Boykin was also trounced in his bid for a seat in the North Carolina legislature. Even more telling than her re-election defeat is what Kim Davis intends to do next. The Rowan County, Kentucky clerk, who gained fame by denying gay and lesbian couples marriage licenses, plans to become an evangelical minister.
It's a little bit sad.
All in all, one of our favorite U.S. midterm winners is Kansas Congressperson-elect Sharice Davids. She's one of HBO's real-time comedian Bill Maher's favorites, too.
Two Native Americans. Deb Hyland from New Mexico, and my favorite, Kansas. Sharice Davids, a lesbian mixed martial arts fighter. Let's see Trump call her Pocahontas.
Power.
straight military personnel will have to shower with homosexual...
What do you think goes wrong when people shower with homosexuals? Do you think it's the spray makes it catching? I mean, we don't get ourselves dry cleaned.
Hello, I'm Barney Frank, and you are listening to This Way Out, the international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
A few U.S. midterm election results are still coming in at a trickle, but the flood of activism is still rising, which means that the work of a lesbian political music duo powerhouse is far from over. This Way Out Music Focus host Steve Sims casts his vote for Emma's Revolution.
Music is a way for individuals to express personal as well as political subjects, and songs by the duo Emma's Revolution are well known for just that reason. That's the song If I Had a Hammer, written by Pete Seeger and Lee Hayes in 1949 in support of the progressive movement. It was a number 10 hit for Peter, Paul, and Mary in 1962, and went on to number 3 a year later when recorded by Trini Lopez. Here it is being performed by Emma's Revolution, the award-winning activist duo of Pat Humphreys and Sandy Oh, whose songs have been sung for the Dalai Lama, praised by Pete Seeger, and covered by Holly Near. This is Pat Humphrey's song Swimming to the Other Side. Author Eileen E. Freeman calls it one of the 10 most awesome and most singable songs ever written. She says don't listen to it unless you're prepared to rethink how you live, love, and laugh. It is also the song that helped connect the Emma's Revolution duo.
I believe if I lived my life again, I'd still be.
This is Emma's Revolution, singing hymn song off the Grammy-nominated album Singing Through the Hard Times, a tribute to Utah Phillips. Their music has been featured on NPR's All Things Considered and Pacifica's Democracy Now!
You know, I think if death really held a knife, we'd all be beggars of life.
This song is Sing, People Sing. It's a song written in tribute to their friend and mentor, Pete Seeger. And it features Pat on banjo and Gary Johnson on accordion. Pat was with the Seeger family and a small group of friends when Pete passed. The duo wrote Sing, People Sing in the days following. It was moving listening to Pat talk about that time.
When I got there, people came from everywhere. Climbed the redwood by the stage.
This song is Peace, Salam, Shalom, written following September 11, 2001, and sang at an impromptu peace march in D.C. that week. Of the song, the duo says, when the only response from the government and corporate media was war and retribution, we wrote Peace, Salam, Shalom. Another song, written following 9/11, was about undocumented workers killed in the World Trade Center. This is If I Give Your Name. Emma's Revolution's latest song is I Believe Her. A week before the Brett Kavanaugh, Dr. Ford hearing, Sandy Yeo says, Pat and I got an email asking us to sing at an upcoming demonstration in San Francisco in support of Dr. Ford. I got the idea for the song that morning, and we finished I Believe Her by the end of breakfast. We recorded it the next night, shot the video 2 days later, and released it the day of the hearing. We and so many others have experienced some level of sexual abuse and/or harassment. It's a very personal as well as a political subject for us, explains O. And Humphreys adds, we needed a way to combat our own feelings of rage and helplessness at the prospect of Brett Kavanaugh being confirmed to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court.
We did not forget, I believe her. She spoke out then,
I believe.
She's speaking now,
I believe.
I still believe,
I believe.
Humphreys praised their collaborators, a group of East Bay women, artists, and sound engineers on both coasts. Humphreys says everybody set aside their other projects to create this recording and video as quickly as possible, so we could give voice to the millions who say, I believe her. Among the collaborators was Vicki Randall of the Mavis Staples Band, and formerly of the Tonight Show Band, who adds cajon and a soaring vocal solo, as well as Irene Young, renowned music photographer and videographer, who filmed, edited, and directed the video. You can learn more about Emma's Revolution at emmasrevolution.com. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Some program material this week came from Wenzel Jones and Monique Lukens, produced with Brian DeShazer, and from Steve Sims. Barbara Streisand, Taylor Mack, and Emma's Revolution performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors who make this program possible. Be sure to visit thiswayout.org before you make your Giving Tuesday commitments on November 27th. Look for This Way Out Radio on social media and wherever you get your podcasts. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon, email tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on 7RGY Jeeveston, Tasmania, KWTF.net Bodega Bay, California, WESU Middletown, Connecticut, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How do the ways that we think about the past limit our visions of the future? In particular, how does our understanding of inequality in human society shape our sense of whether we can radically change our deeply unequal society today? I recently put those questions to anarchist anthropologist David Graeber, who believes so much of what we think about past societies is wrong. The internationally acclaimed writer teaches at the London School of Economics and is the author of many works, including Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and his latest, which I'm going to refer to as BS Jobs. And I sat down with him for an hour to discuss human history and inequality, the influence of the native Huron leader Kondiaronk on Enlightenment thinking, and to talk about the Kurdish YPG, or People's Protection Units, fighting ISIS in Kurdish Syria while struggling for the end of patriarchy. Here's that conversation. So we learn in anthropology class that for most of human history, humans lived in tiny, egalitarian, hunter-gatherer bands,
yeah.
And that the original sin then took place, which was the advent of settled agriculture. People started farming. Out of that, private property, class society emerged.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get
cities.
And you get cities, and you get civilization, which on the one hand may allow for the flourishing of the arts, on the other hand, leads to all the ills that we have lived with ever since. So that is the
The state, for example.
Exactly.
Yes.
And and this is the story that we get.
Yeah.
We get it everywhere. It's a very widely established argument. What's wrong with it?
Well, pretty much everything. This story, it doesn't really come from anthropology. It really comes from the Enlightenment, people like Rousseau and even Adam Smith, you know, the sort of evolution, notion of evolutionary stages. The funny thing is that people were starting to get over it in the early part of the 20th century and realizing the story was somewhat more complicated. But somehow in the 60s, they discovered the Kalahari Bushmen and the Pygmies and kind of this paradigm for primordial innocence. You go back to this kind of Eden utopia idea. But, you know, there's a worm in the bud because it's always assumed that, yes, human beings start innocent and almost like childlikely egalitarian. But the moment you get to any sort of large size, you can no longer maintain that. As soon as there's social complexity, as soon as you have like people, lots of people living together, having to coordinate large projects, you necessarily need hierarchy. It's functional somehow. So thus the dream is either, you know, someday we can return to being primitive again or the equivalent thereof, or maybe somehow we can get beyond. It's never clear, but the dice are so loaded. It just seems the moment we achieve complex society, we're basically doomed. Now, the problem with this is that since then, especially since the 60s, there's been enormous new research evidence. The technology of understanding, you know, analysis has gotten much better. There's been a lot more archaeology. There's been a lot better analysis of the anthropological data. And as a result, we know that pretty much every single part of that story is factually wrong. The problem is that during the period where we've been figuring that out, there's been an incredible abandonment of any public role for archaeologists and anthropologists and most scholars, to be honest. So it's not just that people don't write for the general public. It's not even they don't write for people in other fields. They don't even write for people in other subfields. So you have this incredibly specialized knowledge that nobody's putting together. And me and my friend David Wengrow is an archaeologist. This is a pet peeve of both of ours. We kind of got together and we started going through it. That, all right, if we need another grand narrative, what would it be like? What actually happened? And so, for example, the assumption that we all lived in little Kalahari Bushmen-like bands, it's not true. Even back in 1900, they knew that hunter-gatherers actually much more typically move back and forth seasonally. So they'll live in bands for maybe part of the year, but then they kind of get together. They form these little micro-cities. Often there's monumental architecture, giant feasts and ceremonies. And very often, in fact, the typical pattern is for them to have completely different social structures in different times of year. And this continues into a lot of farming societies, pastoral societies that, you know, for example, I always like to give the example, most plains societies, indigenous societies in North America, a lot of these guys had been farmers and abandoned it and went back to hunting buffalo. Those societies, for 3 months of the year, they would have something very much resembling a state. They'd have a rotating system where different warrior societies or clans would essentially have police powers, could enforce rules arbitrarily. And then during the rest of the year, the other 9 months, they'd be scattered. They do everything by consensus. They would have a completely egalitarian society. So how do you characterize that? You know, they're a band society one time of year and a state society or something very much like it for 3 months during the hunt and the big ritual season. Other ones would go back, like the Inuit, often would be very small patriarchal bands of private property. Then they get together and it was the opposite. When they all got together and built these little micro cities, they would have these giant wife swamping orgies or wife and husband swamping, and they would like collective property arrangements. So they become egalitarian when they were all together and subvert all the hierarchies, and the hierarchies would be reasserted when they broke up into small groups. There's a million different patterns. So the evidence would imply that people are playing around with different social possibilities really from the very beginning. And if you look at the archaeological evidence, suddenly it makes a lot more sense, because what we found is there are these mysterious burials and sites that just don't seem to make sense. If you go back to the Ice Age, even 30,000, 40,000 years ago, you'll find these things that look like royal burials. They have incredible amounts of beads and, you know, scepters and carved ornaments of every kind, and they calculate how many thousands of hours it must have taken people to make this stuff. There sort of exists in magnificent isolation. There'll be suddenly this – most people weren't buried at all, but there'll be like one or two people who are buried in this incredibly magnificent way. And then it never seems to lead to anything. Or sometimes they'll have these giant monuments made of mass mammoth tusks and huge things that are clearly ceremonial. So you have these sort of princely burials are sometimes called. You have these monumental structures, but it doesn't lead to anything like a state. You know, they exist in isolation thousands of years apart. So what do you make of this? And there's an additional really weird thing, which no one seems to know what to do of. The majority of these magnificent burials are physically anomalous in some way. They're either hunchbacks or giants or dwarfs or things like that. You know, so the best explanation we can come up with is that, you know, it's almost like playing at like social forms that had never been permanently institutionalized. These people were king for the 3 month season where everybody got together on the mammoth hunt and whatever it might be that like allowed everyone to get together, and then people dispersed and went back to a completely different way of life.
And are you saying that these seem to be cyclical, or is there any evidence that there was some pushback if things became too egalitarian or too?
The evidence we have is hard to know, but clearly the fact that it didn't become institutionalized shows that there were structures in there to make sure that these people didn't like turn their temporary power into a way to really push people around. And there's a lot of evidence of pushback of different kinds in different times of history. One example that seems fascinating is Stonehenge. Well, there's a bunch of things we've discovered about Stonehenge now. One I always like to point out. The chemical analysis has gotten much better. So there are these things that you always found scattered around Stonehenge and similar megalithic monuments in England. They called them vase stems. They didn't really know what they were, these little cup-like things. And finally, they managed to do trace analysis of the chemicals. They discovered their hash pipes. And also opium was very popular at the time. So basically, the people at Stonehenge then were just as stoned as they are now. So that was
one. You know, some things don't change.
Don't change, yeah. A beer only comes later. And so you have that. But the other thing is that there does seem to have been something like dynasties and kings around Stonehenge, which seems remarkable, but it's even more remarkable when you realize that these are people who not only were they not agricultural, they used to be agricultural and they gave it up. So there was a Neolithic revolution. Everybody said, you know, this is like way too much work. We're going to go back to gathering nuts again. So they kept the pigs and the sheep, but they got rid of all the grain crops. And so they were scattering for most of the year. So for 3 months a year, they'd come together and create these sort of magical courts, but they wouldn't last. And then they break up again.
What about cities and how we understand early cities? Because, of course, the assumption is this was the slide, depending on how you see it, towards greater civilization, or if you're of the sort of more anti-civ stripe,
right?
You know, to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, and we're screwed and that's it. Yeah. That's what's really interesting about cities is that it seems quite likely that many, not all, but many of the first cities were actually more egalitarian than whatever had come before. And this is true in Mesopotamia. If you look at the very first period in Uruk, the first maybe 1,000 years. They used to think it was much shorter, but they realized now it took quite some time. There's no signs of the temples and palaces and, you know what it looks like when there is a hierarchy there. And none of that stuff existed for the first 1,000 years. In fact, you know, what you do have is like large meeting halls clearly designed for everyone to fit in them, things like that. The Indus Valley civilization, Harappan, you know, again, like later you in Indian cities, you can tell right away where the king lived and where the wealthy lived. And in these, the biggest structures were things like large public bath systems, which were clearly designed for everybody in the city. So something's very, very different. And then there's whole civilizations that we didn't even really know about, sometimes because they were, you know, in the former socialist bloc, like the Tripolia civilization, which is through Ukraine to what's now Moldova. They had cities that were actually larger than ones that existed in Mesopotamia around this very beginning. They're sometimes twice as big, but they were all arranged as circles and circles. So there's circles of houses and circles of circles. And again, there's the grave goods are all the same. There's no sense. You know, there'd be one building in each of these circles that would clearly be the collective house, but it was but it's not like some magnificent person lived in them. They were clearly egalitarian cities. So there's a lot of those. And another interesting thing is that there's a tendency for cities to develop hierarchy and then change their minds. There's some of that in very early China. Some of the early cities, there's a palace and it gets burned down. But the one I always find most fascinating is Teotihuacan. You know, Teotihuacan is a place a lot of people go to nowadays. It's got these amazing giant temples of the sun and moon. Those were built at the very beginning. And there was temples where there was a mass human sacrifice. There seemed to be a clear center of government there. Something happens. It wasn't even – in China, seems to be some kind of violent revolution. They burned down the palaces. There, it wasn't even that. Something happens around 200 AD maybe where – they bury the temple where they're doing all the human sacrifice and stop doing that. And the city is rebuilt as this, you know, over 1,000 very large, comfortable villas, all exactly the same size. Hmm. And that's where everybody lives. It's like really, really nice, like housing estates, public housing. And it stays that way for 400, 500 years. And even the art in Teotihuacan, like all the figures are exactly the same size. They're trying to telegraph here as clearly as they can. Yeah? But for a very long time, archaeologists know there must be a palace. We just haven't found it yet. You know, there had to be government. It's a giant city. It was like, you know, at least 120,000 people there, and like, you know, 400, might have been one of the largest cities in the world at the time. And there's no signs of a centralized monarchical or any other kind of government.
That's David Graeber, anthropologist and anarchist, and we're talking about what we know and what we don't know about the history of equality and inequality in human history. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So what do we know about the emergence of a more, let's just say, enduring class society where it doesn't seem to just sort of yo-yo back and forth?
Well, it's hard to say where these things come from, but the problem of scale is not the problem. We've been looking at exactly the opposite. I mean,
scale meaning the bigger it gets.
The bigger it gets, the more you need top-down systems of management and control. That's been the assumption for a long time. But you know, a lot of ethnographic evidence has shown the base assumptions this is based on are just not true. Irrigation systems. I used to think once you have a complex irrigation system, you need a bureaucracy to run it. But now that we've like looked at places, like Bali is a great example, where you have really, really complex irrigation systems. Actually, you know, there's thousands of water temples of like, you know, local elected elders, you know, who coordinate together. There is no central control. There are states, but they actually have nothing to do with all this bureaucratic, I mean, or all of this water administration that people assumed was what made states it's possible. So insofar as there are states and places with a lot of irrigation, it's largely because if you spent 20, 30 years building an irrigation system, you're less likely to run away when someone comes and tries to shake you down. You know? The states are parasitical off this stuff rather than organizing it themselves.
You had earlier said that although there's been all of this new scholarship, and some of it not so new, but over that scholars have been writing for these very, very specialized audiences and not for the public. But one person who has been writing for the public and who does make the argument of large-scale organization needing top-down rule and of a primordial innocent past that we have left and must never return to is Jared Diamond.
Yes, he is.
I wonder if you could comment on his work.
Well, I don't want to say anything too mean. The important to bear in mind that Jared Diamond is a I believe his degree was in some medical thing, and then he became an ornithologist. But he's not actually an anthropologist, you know. What he does is he just repeats the common wisdom that we're all trained to expect. And someone actually wants to find – I don't like the word pop, you know. People say, oh, that's pop science. You know, sometimes they just mean like that science that you can actually understand. Mm-hmm. It's very elitist. But insofar as anyone's ever come up with a – reasonable definition of what is pop and what's wrong with it, like it would be this, that like pop theory is theory that gives you reasons you never would have thought of to believe what you already think. And that's kind of what these guys do. They come up with really clever ideas for why conventional wisdom is in fact true. And conventional wisdom isn't true. This is what Jared Diamond basically does. He gives you the same story we've been hearing for 250 years. But I'll tell you an interesting story about how we got to that conventional wisdom, which he's simply repeating, really. If you look at the Enlightenment and Enlightenment ideas, a lot of it traces back to North America and to indigenous sources. I mean, I actually think that the Enlightenment actually started in North America before the settlers actually showed up. But that's kind of a long, complicated story. One thing that I did look into in quite great detail, I looked at the French literature because it's very rich and easily accessible. There's all these Jesuit relations of, you know, what indigenous people, what First Nations in what's now Canada thought of the settlers, the missionaries, when they first showed up. You know, what was the indigenous critique? And it's interesting because it's quite consistent. It's the whole idea of egalitarian societies, which then is the way we now characterize them. It wasn't the way it started. Nobody talked on either side about equality, as they talked about freedom. So indigenous people were basically said, look, you guys just follow orders all the time. You're afraid of your commanders. I mean, we have chiefs. We just ignore them if we don't like what they say. You know, they have no power to make us do anything we don't want to do. We laugh at them. You guys run around like a bunch of slaves. And they say that. And they also say you don't take care of each other. So you know, if somebody's in trouble, nobody bails them out. You have people sleeping on the street. What the hell is wrong with you guys? And, you know, you're not nice people. But in there was a similar idea, which is that, you know, it's not inequalities of wealth that was an issue for them because, you know, some people have a lot of, you know, wampum or other, you know, treasures that were things that were considered most valuable things. People would have differential amounts of that stuff. There's no way to turn wealth into power. Just because I've got more of this than you do doesn't mean I can make you do something you don't want to do. Certainly, I can't make you work for me. Now, and so at first, like a lot of the First Nation people didn't understand that that wasn't the case in French society. So they were criticizing them for not being very nice. You know, here are these people who are desperate. You don't help them out. And therefore, they're not able to be free, autonomous people. You know, so you're not free in two ways. Sometimes you're poor and you can't be free. And even if you're not poor, if you're not the one guy who's in power, you're just following orders and you're afraid of somebody. So gradually, however, and it's very interesting because if you read the Jesuit accounts, you know, we're all used to this idea that, like, they're the Westerners, this is the Western gaze, they're basically us, and these indigenous people are some alien other. But in fact, it's the indigenous people are basically making the points we would make if we were there. And it's the French guys are weird, you know. So they're all, like, you know, these devout Christians. And they actually say, like, okay, these guys are the most free people who ever lived. This is a problem. We want them to become Christian. That means like 10 commandments, obedience. You know, that's like a basic principle. And they say, well, you know, the system, it doesn't seem to make any sense. They don't have any like punitive laws. They just have this system of mediation and compensation and shaming. And says, and you know what? To be honest, it kind of works better than in France. Like there's less crime actually, but that's not the point. The point is they're supposed to follow orders. If they don't understand following orders, how are they going to, like, find God? So it's exactly the opposite of the usual critique of anarchism, right? They're not saying, well, it's a lovely idea, but, like, it would never work. They say, yeah, it works fine, but it's a terrible idea. So, you know, stop that. Stop being so free. It's, like, bad. Okay, so it's all about freedom. But then gradually the indigenous, like the indigenous observers, they start going to French towns. They build up Montreal. Some of them travel to New York and places like that. They get sent diplomatic missions to France. And gradually they sort of figure out, oh, I see. It's all about money and property. You guys have a system where you can take wealth and make that into a way to push people around, which just hadn't even occurred to them before. Because that potential didn't really exist in any developed sense or any sense often in their own societies. So then, okay, the key moment, there's this guy named Baron Lahontan. In the 1680s, he's a teenager, sort of aristocrat from an impoverished family. They lose their inheritance. He joins the army, send him to Canada. He learns Huron and Algonquian, hangs out with a lot of indigenous people, becomes friends with this guy named Kandiyohonk, who's actually, I think, one of the most important figures in the last several hundred years of intellectual history. And gradually he gets in trouble. He has to run off. He's basically a wanted man in France. He's living homeless in Amsterdam for a while. But he starts writing these books of his memoirs, which are insanely successful, ends up in the same court as Leibniz and lives happily ever after. This book that's a big bestseller is called Curious Conversations with an Interesting Savage Who Has Traveled to France. This got basically it's about Kandiyohonk. But He calls him a Dario.
And how do you spell his name?
K-A-N-D-I-A-R-O-N-K. It's usually spelled of an O, but like as people now, Iroquoian speakers say, it can't really be an O. Anyway, this guy is sometimes he's just called Le Rat, the rat, because that's what the name means. He was a Huron statesman, and everybody assumed that this guy was like a sock puppet. He was some guy Lahontan made up. But a bunch of indigenous scholars have gone through the material and say, no, everybody says he was a real guy. He was the most eloquent person anybody had ever met. He was this brilliant politician who was always outwitting the French. But he also, there was this little salon where he was so good at arguing that they would invite him to the governor's house. And they sit around to debate Christianity or debate like, you know, social organization and what's better, which are better ways. And Lahontan took notes on all this stuff. So it was an actual, these were actual conversations. And the arguments he made are exactly the same ones. You find other, you know, indigenous Iroquoian speakers especially. He has a hilarious critique of Christianity. And back then, you know, the book comes out in 1704. So you couldn't actually make fun of Christianity. The only thing you could do is have somebody else do it, pretend to be arguing with them and make sure you always lose the argument. and so this is what happens. Basically, almost all the arguments, which are later to become enlightenment sort of arguments, the anti-clerical stuff, the egalitarian stuff, it all comes from Lahontan and thus comes from Kandirak. This book's a huge bestseller.
So you're saying that's the origin of Enlightenment thinking.
A lot of the Enlightenment radicalism. What we now think of as egalitarian thought comes from this guy, who's like a Huron Wendat, giving like what was a really sophisticated, because he was incredibly brilliant, version of the standard Wendat critique of French people. And it turns out he had been to Paris. They sent him out a delegation to meet Louis XIV and so forth and so on. So he had a chance to observe it himself. Okay, here's where it gets interesting. So this guy, the book becomes a huge hit. Every single Enlightenment thinker writes a imitation of it. Voltaire has a half-Huron guy. Let's see, Diderot is a Polynesian. Rousseau, we all know what he does. Basically, all of these guys sort of take it up. So the idea of how you critique French societies, pretend to be an indigenous person and use these same kind of arguments. It all comes to a peak with a woman named Madame Givenchy. She is one of the Salonists, and she writes one where it's an imaginary sort of indigenous feminist critique. It's an Inca princess who's kidnapped to France. This is 1755, like 50 years later, and making fun of French society. It's actually a feminist milestone because it's the first novel we know of with a female protagonist who doesn't either marry or die at the end. But, okay, so this Inca princess is sort of making fun of French society. The book's a huge hit, big bestseller. She has to do a second edition. So we have her correspondence. She sent around copies to her friends saying, I need to change it around a little for the second edition. What should I do? So it goes to Turgot, who's, as we know, the guy who invents the idea of progress, right? But this is like the moment we can, you know, in this correspondence, we can see it happen. He's reading this book and he's saying, I don't know. This is kind of, I don't know, the political implications of this is kind of disturbing because, like, okay, sure, we're all for freedom and equality and in principle, but can you maintain a complex commercial society like that? Well, you know, I think you should have her realize at the end of the book that there are stages of development, evolution. And this is like where evolution is first proposed, as far as we know.
Sounding very familiar.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that, like, you know, when you're a hunter-gatherer or something like that, sure, you can have this. And even as a farmer in the, like the Incas, but, you know, as soon as you get up to the complex stage of modern, they didn't have industry yet, you know, modern commercial society, then you need to have a division of labor, you need to have hierarchy, and she should realize that because the payoff in terms of prosperity is, you know, greater than the sacrifice and freedom and equality. And she says, yeah, like how to put that in, never mind. But so she ignores him. But the next year he gives this great speech on the idea of progress where he develops this. Adam Smith takes it up. Before you know it, you have evolution. But so the whole notion of stages of evolutionary development is actually invented as a direct response to the indigenous critique of European society, which is like incredibly popular.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined by anarchist anthropologist David Graeber. He's the author of a number of books, including On Kings, Debt, the First 5,000 Years, and the book BS Jobs. That's the FCC-compliant version of the title.
Isn't kind of guess what the title might be.
Indeed. And I'm Sasha Lilly. So to talk about political implications,
yes,
What are the political implications of imagining that for most of human history, we lived in a egalitarian way, but we were in these very small units? And then after that, you know, the original sin of settled agriculture, we lost all of that. We became these complex, larger and larger societies. The state emerged, class society emerged.
Mm-hmm.
On the one hand, you might say, well, but doesn't that allow us to believe that at one point, actually for the majority of our history, we lived in an egalitarian way? On the other hand, the implication may be that that is a world that is now closed to us. How do you see it?
Well, I mean, yes, the idea was we lived in an egalitarian way, but it's always followed by the assumption that since the fall, you know, since we sought after knowledge and appropriately, we're stuck, you know. Whereas if you look at this narrative that's beginning to emerge of what seems to have actually happened, and I haven't even gone into the actual origins of agriculture, which are much different than people assume. And, you know, if agriculture creates social inequality, why does it take 4,000 years for any changes to occur? You know, if you look at what really happened, what you see is that people are adults. They're not children who've not figured out inequality, and as soon as it happens to them, they're kind of stuck there. They're playing around with different possibilities. We've always been self-conscious about social possibilities. You know, if we are anything as humans, it's people have some control over the condition of our existence. We make our own worlds. And it used to be not that we were like these innocent creatures who would never let sort of open Pandora's box. It's much more a matter of we used to have more control. We used to actually be able to say, all right, we will create hierarchies for 3 months and then rip them down again. And people would literally build these monuments and then rip them down again. And somehow, so the normal state of human affairs is to move back and forth between different social possibilities, to play around. So hierarchies exist almost in play form before they exist in real form. So the question is how we got stuck in one mode. It's like we were playing this costume drama and suddenly we forgot we were playing a costume drama, and here we have been ever since. Yeah, that's what happened. As Marshall Solins points out, you know, states exist in the imagination. Like, you know, people imagine these all-powerful gods who can punish you for infractions and impose codes on you. You know, in hunter-gatherer societies, we're nothing like a state apparatus at all. So people are imagining all these things. But somehow we end up stuck in one mode of, and it's a particularly awful mode.
And is it clear, is there a timeline that could be agreed on of when we got stuck?
Well, at different times and places, because sometimes we got unstuck. And that's the other thing which is important. Like, okay, this is, if you look at the story of Kondiaronk, I think the other interesting thing we learn, so they came up with this idea of evolution. We still have people say, oh, there were bands and then there were tribes and then you get chiefdoms and you get kingdoms and states. But if you look at the history of North America that produced people like that, that's not what happened at all. You know, you have like these hunter-gatherer societies which go back and forth between bands and concentrations. You have the Hopewell civilization, which is not even agricultural, where they're building these astrological giant monuments and crazy ritual centers. And then that turns it suddenly into a state, I guess, leap directly into a state. Cahokia, it seems almost like this giant empire, this huge city, bigger than anything that exists any before or after in North America, in what's now East St. Louis. So they go from hunter-gatherers to bam, you know, like this empire. Then the empire dissolves, and we don't know why. And that area where it used to be becomes like a forbidden zone on Planet of the Apes or something. Like nobody lives anywhere nearby for hundreds of years. And okay, then you get chiefdoms coming out of that. Then those chiefdoms collapse and turn into these sort of polis-sized republics where everybody's sitting around and, you know, smoking tobacco and drinking caffeinated beverages and discussing politics, is what I'm saying. It's a sort of proto-enlightenment happening in North America before the Europeans even show up. And as they're like, you know, like the Cherokee or the Osage or, you know, people like that. And sometimes they hit, you know, if you look at Cherokee myths, they're really direct. They say, yeah, once upon a time, there used to be this hereditary caste of priests, and they used to push us around and abuse women and do terrible things. So we killed them all, and now we don't have hereditary leadership. I mean, they're just like totally direct, right? And somehow people won't put two and two together. So, you know, the settlers show up, and they find these guys who are staunchly egalitarian, or like they're hippies talking about nature and being one with the cosmos. And it doesn't occur to them that this is, you know, maybe a political thing. You know, there used to be these, like, all around them, there's these giant mounds of what used to be cities, like, abandoned. And, like, here's these, like, guys saying, oh, no, no, we're against any kind of hierarchy. And it never occurs to them to put two together that, you know, what you're actually seeing of guys like Kondiaronk is the egalitarian ideology that formed in reaction to and probably overthrew all of these, like, urban civilizations and empires and so forth. So politics exists at all times. So, you know, it's not like once we're stuck, we can't get unstuck. He got unstuck. And then, of course, you know, the settlers came and killed them all. But nonetheless, the history is full of these kind of movements and possibilities.
Which, obviously, we have a complete amnesia about now. And the implication is that there's clearly been increased concern about inequality. Mm-hmm. But the implication still is that to become egalitarian means to return to forms that are no longer possible.
Yes. And it's, I'd actually even think the word inequality is kind of loaded. Because what does it mean? You know, I mean, what would a absolutely equal society be like?
Rather than using words like class power, we don't hear that.
Yeah.
Inequality kind of lends itself as a term to milquetoast solutions.
Yeah, technocratic, you know, let's tinker around a little bit, adjust the Gini coefficient. I think a little too much wealth is concentrating. You know, let's distribute it a little more that way. Maybe the tax system should be skewered that way. So it's basically about going to, like, you know, the G8 summit and readjusting and, you know, proposing ideas to, like, rejigger things rather than fundamentally change structures, because they're assumed. So obviously, we're not going to have a society where everybody's exactly the same. I mean, come on, who would want that? So, you know, and I go back to that indigenous critique, and I think one of the really interesting things about it is that they weren't talking about equality. That equality discourse only comes when they discover that you can turn wealth into power. But that's exactly what they were really objecting to. You know, instead of talking about equality, you know, what they were really saying and I think what people actually object to about what they call social inequality is not that, like, you know, you got a bigger house. I mean, maybe, okay, or maybe you have a bigger house and I have more books and you have, you know, well, there's things are incommensurable anyway, right? What they're objecting to is that some people can turn their wealth into power and push people around, and that other people who do not have things are considered unimportant and their perspectives and lives and needs don't matter. So that's the thing that people are objecting to, not the actual number of things people have. So if you can get – and you can't, you know, exactly adjust things so that everybody has the same, nor would you really want to. But you can get rid of a system where people can turn wealth into the ability to push the people around, and a system where anybody is told, I don't care what you want.
Is there the other side for the not very large population relative to those with sort of mainstream notions about what is possible and what is not possible, but for those people still, you know, burning the torch of the radical left?
Yes, that if like you, me.
That if we no longer imagine that so much of human history was just simply equality, not some oscillation back and forth, then how can we imagine a future that is one of equality that isn't, I don't know, market socialism or some variation back and forth between equality and inequality?
Right. I mean, I think that the word freedom has been fallen into disrepute. People don't like it. They assume that it's a bourgeois liberal concept. Of course, that's ironic since, as I was pointing out, it really, more than anything else, first of all, comes out of movements of slaves. Freedom is the opposite of slavery. And second of all, the sort of indigenous people who have the certain notion of inherent liberty and autonomy of the individual, which is then adopted, you know, in Europe, which is a society which wasn't like that at all, you know. Be this as it may, I think that our, you know, it's you can learn something from those societies. What they're essentially saying is it's not the equality that matters. It's when equality impedes on people's ability to autonomously or collectively decide for themselves how they want to live, and where it turns into an ability to basically push people around and tell people to do things they don't want to do. So I think we need to reimagine what the purpose of these economic and social arrangements are, what it is we're actually trying to achieve. There are non-liberal notions of freedom, and we need to recuperate those.
Well, and to just extend that a bit further, the implications of all of this for the present, for the future. Clearly, we live in times where what people tend to expect for the future is not particularly sunny. Obviously, global warming adds to that, but also the sense of the possible, the politically possible, given the past and the recent past. And one aspect of that, which actually global warming has a part to play in, is this notion that we might be able to live in a way that is more equal, more free, and also more sustainable. And
the degrowth, for example.
Right. And so the implication is, no, it is not possible on the sort of scale that we all live in to be able to live differently. And the only way to even consider it would be a radical scaling back. It sounds like you're mounting a defense of the ability for us to live in radically free and egalitarian ways on a large scale.
Yeah, because this happened before. And you know, it's, the evidence is right in front of our eyes, and we just refuse to see it. You know, here you have these giant egalitarian cities that used to exist not that far away, you know. And we're just sort of saying, no, that can't be true. That didn't happen because it can't, you know, it's similar to when I talk about the BS jobs. You'll have people say, well, we have a market system, so nobody would hire someone to what isn't economically advantageous to them. So therefore, the fact that 40% of the population feels they're doing pointless jobs, they must all be wrong. Can't be happening because, you know, our basic picture of the way society works says it can't be happening, so it isn't. I don't care what empirical evidence you put in front of my eyes. It's very similar with history. We just don't see what's in front of us. There's all the negative space in the picture. You know, if you just flip it around, the picture looks really different. One thing that David Wengrow points out, he's worked on a lot of work in Egypt. He says no one's quite sure how to do the numbers, but there's what they call interdynastic periods. Interdynastic periods is when they didn't actually have a pharaoh. It's like the interregnum. You assume that's like 10, 20 years, but actually no. There's like several hundred usually. And in fact, it's quite possible that there's more interdynastic periods than there are dynastic periods in ancient Egyptian history. In other words, for like at least half the time, there was no pharaoh. There was no giant monuments being built. So what were they doing then? We just ignore that. You know, why don't we write a history of Egypt in which pharaohs are the exception, and normally they're just getting on with their lives without them? So there's a lot more happening in history than we imagine. And if we go back, we discover that social possibilities are much, much richer than we would be inclined to imagine.
David Graeber is my guest. He is professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So looking back at least what we can tell, what we can divine, because some of this obviously isn't always clear, about the range of possibilities and the ways that societies have shifted back and forth between varying degrees of equality and inequality, you're saying, and of course it's fairly obvious to see, that we are live in a time where that dynamic is stuck, that the oscillation...
We're stuck in one mode.
We're stuck in one mode, and switching to the other mode seems very hard to conceive of. Are there any indications, looking back, about what unsticks something that's stuck, or is there anything that you would extrapolate from the past in thinking about the present?
Yeah, I mean, there's a big debate about that right now, but there's people like Scheidel. I don't know if you know him, wrote a book where he tried to argue that the only thing that's really like stopped galloping inequality has been catastrophe.
Yes,
and I don't think that's true.
This is a writer on the right.
Yes, he's a right wing, like a Walter Scheidel. He's like kind of our nemesis. And on the one hand, he's written some very interesting perceptive stuff about money that I used when I was writing Debt. The other, he sort of went off the deep end, in my opinion, and came with this incredibly pessimistic approach. And on the other hand, like things that look historically like catastrophes and disasters, because we're reading a history that's written by rich and powerful people, actually, you know, probably look really different if you were on the bottom of the social hierarchy. So look at the Dark Ages, where everything is supposed to collapse. You know, if you're talking about the Roman Empire, they have all these cities which are basically, you know, fed by slave labor. Or, you know, for every person who's like declaiming poetry in you know, Roman Damascus, there's like five guys like living their entire lives being peons in Egypt, you know, producing grain for them. And all right, so you know, in the Dark Ages, those five guys got free. You know, 40% by some estimation, probably exaggerated, but 30% of the population of Roman Italy were slaves. After the Goths, Visigoths, Vandals, and Huns came through, none of them were slaves. I mean, so it might have been disaster for the Senate, who got massacred, and a lot of the, you know, sort of middle-class people really suffered, but slaves did pretty well, you know? I mean, so Dark Age for whom, exactly? So again, you know, something really interesting happened across Eurasia in those years of the sort of beginning of the Middle Ages, where slavery was essentially abolished in most of Eurasia. How did that happen? It's one of the great historic, must have been a social movement of some kind. From Europe, it had to have something to do with the church, but we don't know what, because almost no church father is actually against slavery. Yet somehow they reached a situation where all the slaves got freed. How did that happen? You know, things like that have happened throughout history, and even in the midst of disasters. I don't think it necessarily has to go through catastrophe and disaster, but there has to be disruption and reshuffling of the deck. Sometimes that can not be pretty, but if you look at what's going on right now, you know, we're living through some pretty non-pretty times if you happen to be in many parts of the world. Question is what will come of it. So I think that we're also living in unprecedented times because things happen faster and communications are so much quicker than they were before, that it's possible to have transformations that are coordinated across the world in ways that never happened before. I think the social possibilities for change are dramatic. What they've been doing for the last 30 or 40 years has been trying to convince us of the opposite, that somehow the rise of technology, information systems, all this incredibly rapid computer stuff has created a situation where our social possibilities are dramatically less than they were before. I always point this out to people. I had an argument with Peter Thiel about this, actually. He's pointed out,
Peter Thiel, the right-wing libertarian founder of PayPal.
Yeah. Because we were talking about technological stagnation, which is something we both agree with and think is a problem. And I actually said, okay, think about it this way. You know, for most of human history, there were 20, you know, when people were carting around wheat and ox carts, there are 27 different ways, like, you could organize an economy. Now we have super fast computers, and supposedly now there's just one. I thought technology was supposed to increase our social possibilities. And he was like, yeah, I guess you got a point. There probably are other ways we could organize the economy. We just haven't thought of them yet. And I, you know, if you had all the guys who were sitting around figuring out how ways to do, like, you know, really super fast trading derivatives, and had said, no, come up with something other than capitalism as a way of, like, distributing goods and services, I'm sure they'd come up with 20 different alternative economies in a matter of weeks, you know, if we had all those guys with something interesting to do for a change. There's, you know, the only reason they haven't is because, you know, there's been this intense and continual effort to basically kill the human imagination and tell us, no, forget it. Don't even think about another way. Don't even think about another system.
And some of that entails assumptions about human nature. We're told that human nature is a particular way, and that just can't be changed.
Right. But if that were true, you wouldn't have had the 37 different ways of organizing economies before this. So then they try to rewrite history and say, well, it might look like other systems, but really it was the same. For which they have to cook the books in all sorts of crazy ways. Yeah, it's a way of. I mean, it's crazy things that, like, are treated as inevitable that didn't even exist 20 years ago. I noticed this in the UK. Like, they got rid of free education under Blair, you know, in the 90s, and then they massively increased the tuition in 2010 to huge protests. And nowadays, there's a student movement for Restore Free Education, which has been adopted by the opposition party now. And, you know, when I first propose it, the first reaction you get from hundreds of people is, how could that be possible? We could not possibly afford. Where is that money going to come from to afford free education? It's like, okay, we live in England. To the north, Scotland, they still have free higher education. To the west, Ireland, they still have free education. France, Belgium, Germany, every single country anywhere around us has this. And you're saying it's inconceivable. How could you possibly say such a thing? So it's really fascinating how that brainwashing works.
Let me end by asking you about how you think that radicals can help push things in a way that we can unstick the situation that we're stuck in. Mm. I mean, the prevailing ideology, as you've described, is one of a hopelessness about any change beyond the present. The present is the best we can expect.
A cultivated hopelessness, yes.
Indeed.
Yes.
So how can we struggle against that hopelessness? And I don't mean in terms of a cheering squad, but how does one counter, how should radicals counter that ideological campaign in a way that you think might be effective, shifting things in a different direction?
We need to look at both what's happened in the past and also what's happening now. I mean, one of the things that fascinates me, and this is, I think, a symptom of this sort of collapse and abandonment of the responsibility for hope. I mean, I really think that you know, if we can't know whether a good society is possible, which we can't, this is what Chomsky makes this argument. I kind of agree with him on this one. Well, he says, well, why not just assume that it is if you can't know? Better to, like, live with hope, you know? I say it's a responsibility to others to do that. You know, I mean, I'd go further. I think there is a responsibility to actually look at the possibilities for improvement and take the risk, you know? I mean, that they are possible. But if you look around, I mean, what people do is the opposite. They look around and they just can't believe that good things really are happening when they are. I mean, the example I always give is Kurdistan, is Rojava, where I just got back from another visit to Rojava a few weeks ago. And I find it...
And this is where the YPG is fighting against...
Against the remains of ISIS and now against Turkey, which basically had been the sponsor of ISIS all along. But now kind of dropped the pretense and attacked them directly.
Have embraced a radical ideology, radical politics.
Yes. The philosophy, which is largely developed... Well, I mean, it's emerged from the PKK and there's sort of movements of women within the PKK sort of challenged its old Marxist ideology, and gradually Öcalan, who's the sort of intellectual leader of the PKK, have embraced this stuff. And especially while he's been in prison, he's been reading a lot of Murray Bookchin and sort of took up the idea of social ecology, democratic confederalism, but doing a Kurdish version of that with a very, very strong, you know, emphasis not just on ecology but on women's rights. And you know, replacing the notion of proletarian revolution as women's revolution, gender has to come first. So basically when I was in Rojava, people said quite frequently, they said, well, you know, we're anti-capitalist, but we've learned from the 20th century that you can't get rid of capitalism without getting rid of the state, and you can't get rid of the state without getting rid of patriarchy. Well, how to get rid of patriarchy? It's going to be a long and complicated process, but making sure all women have access to automatic weapons, that's a start, you know. So, you know, all those images you see of women with machine guns, that's not a coincidence. That's also not just like, oh, they're desperate, they'll arm anybody. No, it's very, very self-conscious feminist ideology going on there. And the fascinating thing to me is why – and aren't revolutionaries all over the world saying, oh, my God, it's, you know, Spain 1937-6 all over again. You know, I mean, some are, right? But the reaction on the part of, like, probably majority at first of leftist organizations is this can't be real. They're faking it. They're pretending to be, like, libertarian communists and eco-feminists, you know, just to get our attention. Which is, of course, first of all, deeply racist. But even aside from that, I mean, it's like the most narcissistic, absurd position I've ever heard. It's like, that's right. They're a bunch of Stalinists. This is the line. But in order to get, like, you know, Western left support, they're pretending to be anarchists. Like, sure, if I wanted to fake an ideology to get international support, I'd choose anarchism. That's going to happen. They're not total idiots. You know, if you're going to fake an ideology, you're going to pretend to either be a liberal or an Islamist. Those guys have guns. They have tanks and planes they'll give you. It's absurd. Yeah. But it shows something about the sort of defeatism that people just can't believe it's really happening.
Well, let me leave it right there. David Graeber, it's been a great pleasure to talk to you today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to be allowed to come here and rant with you.
David Graeber is an anarchist anthropologist, author of many books. Mm-hmm. He teaches at the London School of Economics, and his books include The Utopia of Rules, On Kings, and his latest is BS Jobs. If you Google it, you'll find the full name. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time.
Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.